Pilot Channel in Smuggler's Gulch. So a couple of questions to the regional board is, what is the regional board doing about this? Has staff been in communication with the city of San Diego? And if so, why has nothing happened yet? It is also my understanding that the city is pointing fingers at the county of San Diego because the county of San Diego is responsible for clearing out sediment and trash from the channel, which has piled up at an alarming rate. Again, I've been there. I invite all of you to take a look at
Actually,
this.
Actually, we have been there.
Okay. Yeah, it's...
And we got a really excellent photo of exactly what you're talking about.
All right.
Just recently.
Well, there you go. And so I asked the regional board to force the city and the county to work together to figure this out. And if need be, for the regional board to use its authority to make that happen as soon as possible. And then a separate second issue, San Diego Coast Keeper also asked that the regional board request that IBWC provide an unredacted version of the June 2023 Arcadis report that assessed the condition of the international treatment plant. And also provided a rehabilitation plan. IBWC has only produced, through FOIA requests, an extremely redacted version of this to Coastkeeper, to media outlets like the Voice of San Diego, and congressional representatives like Congressman Issa and others. Anything less than full transparency for the situation is unacceptable in our eyes. The public is demanding more information. IBWC received $300 million in 2020, like many years ago now at this point, which they said was enough, and then it's nowhere near enough. And this report has the answers and information of why that's the case. And I think a lot of people are asking why this is the case, and yet all we get is a bunch of black boxes. So we asked the regional board, it's my understanding that the regional board has not yet requested that report in unredacted form from the IBWC. So my second request to the board is to request that information and find out what's happening. Thank you.
Thank you. Don't know how we might force the city and county to work together. That would be a new talent, skill to develop. But thank you for your testimony. The board now will consider the adoption of our board meeting minutes of April the 10th of this year. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
I'll second it.
Any discussion, corrections? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Tu?
Aye.
Chair Cantor?
Aye. Motion carries. This is the time and place for us to share updates since the last month from the board members' perspective with people in the room and on Zoom, and also to hear from our state board liaison, Nicole Morgan, who has submitted a report to us, but will not be able to join us today except for on Zoom. This is also the opportunity for us to ask any questions of our executive officer regarding his very comprehensive report, executive officer's report.
Chair Cantu?
Yes.
Ms. Morgan is online if you'd like to have her.
Please invite her now. Thank you. I know she is pressed for time today, and she is squeezing us in, which I very much appreciate.
Good morning, Chair Cantu, and there's a board. Apologies. I am tongue-tied this morning. So have an update for you all this morning. So let's see here. On April 10th, the Biden-Harris administration issued the first ever national legally enforceable drinking water standard to protect communities from exposure to harmful per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, also known as PFAS. This final rule represents the most significant step to protect public health under EPA's PFAS strategic roadmap. So also on drinking water, on April 17th, the state board voted to adopt a maximum contaminant level, an MCL of 10 parts per billion for hexavalent chromium, also known as chrome 6. A cancer-causing contaminant, the new MCL will reduce effective Californians' potential exposure to chrome 6 to one-fifth the current regulatory level. So, going to give you a little bit of an update on SGMA. So it's not happening in your area, but something I know many throughout California are following. On April 16th, the board held a hearing to designate and designated the Tulare Lake sub-basin as probationary as a probationary basin pursuant to SGMA. So this was the first basin that we began the hearing process on and the very first under SGMA to be designated as probationary. The Tule Basin is the second basin that is going through this process. On April 5th, State Water Board staff held a virtual workshop regarding the proposed designation of the Tule Sub-Basin as probationary. And on April 8th, staff held an in-person workshop in Porterville. The State Water Board will hold a hearing on September 17th to determine whether or not to place the basin under probation, and public comment will be accepted on the staff report until May 7th at noon. So changing subjects to once through cooling, on April 17th, the board adopted a resolution to revise the interim mitigation payment calculation for the water quality control policy on the use of coastal and estuarine waters for power plant cooling and proposed final staff report. So the Bay Delta, big subject here, ongoing. The board held a multi-day public workshop to discuss voluntary agreements, also known as VAs, on April 24th through 26th as part of the update to the Bay Delta plan. The proposed workshop was part of the VA parties to provide a detailed overview of the proposal, receive input and answer questions from board members, and receive input from the public. Also wanted to provide a little bit on the Safe and Affordable Funding for Equity and Resilience, our SAFER program. The advisory group will hold its second meeting for this year on May 2nd. A quorum of state board members may be present, but no action will be taken. The hearing will be, the advisory group meeting will be in person, webcast and include comments, and also Spanish interpretation will be available. So that concludes my report for this month. I am available if there are any questions.
Any questions for Board Member Morgan? Dr. Olson?
Although this wasn't on your report, the federal government recently released new standards on the PFOS, sort of PFOA family, which was 4 parts per trillion. I wondered what if there were comments coming up to the state about it and what was the nature of them.
Well, so far, just asking what is going to be the process of us, as far as the state implementing the new federal standard and the compliance of that. And so our Division of Drinking Water is responding to those. It is a federal standard, so yes, we will be complying with it. We're still going through our process and adopting, state limits and moving through that. So there is a compliance pathway. I can't remember the exact years of how that lays out, but there was also an information order that did go out from the Division of Drinking Water to all of those that are impacted. We're also working with our wastewater facilities to also let them know how that may, I shouldn't say how they will be impacted, because that will go through the regional boards, but they are also coming up to the state board asking, questions. We are referring them back to the regional boards for further clarification.
So do you anticipate that there will be an MCL for wastewater discharge?
As far as state board, we are implementing the MCL for drinking water discharge.
Yeah, that's I understand.
Yeah, for just for drinking water. And so the question for the wastewater is just, will there then be, because some basin plants do have an automatic trigger that when there's a drinking water MCL, that automatically that goes into their wastewater, their MPDS permits. And so that is what is being asked to the state board. So we're referring them back to the regional boards of how that will be implemented into their MPDS permits.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? I'm really thrilled to hear about the Chrome 6. That's been in the works for, I think, 25 years. So it's great to have it maybe done and moving on to implementation. That's a good move. There's been a lot of fits and starts and retooling. So I think we've got it right this time. I'm really thrilled. So good work. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Thank you for making time for us and for your written report, which was very comprehensive. At this point, we'll move. Any board members have updates from the last 30 days? I have one. Executive officer and apt staff, talented staff, met with the Choyas Creek Climate Collaborative kickoff a couple weeks ago. And an enthusiastic community-led neighborhood group, very concerned about the effects of climate change on Choyas Creek and their community, looking at a comprehensive long list of actions and concerns that they can take place. So it was fun and interesting to see that kind of energy and insight and just smart people working hard to see if they can make a difference. And I really wish them the very best of luck. Any questions for our executive officer on his report? Do you have any updates?
Good morning, Chair Cantu, members of the board, and members of the public. Yes, we have some time before the commissioner will be ready to address the board on item number 3. She's taking an elected official's phone call upstairs, and she'll be brought down. So since I have the opportunity, I will go on at length for a little bit, if you'll indulge me.
Thank you.
First of all, I just wanted to inform the board, as I have done in years past, next Tuesday, on May 14th, I will be participating in a San Diego Bay tour with the Industrial Environmental Association for local consultants, agency staff, and so on. I have not yet decided what I'm going to talk about for a couple hours on the bay while everyone else enjoys a drink or a beverage or something to eat, but I will have done in the past is the history of San Diego Bay and the Water Board's efforts to address cleanup sites, permitting issues, and other things that you may have an opportunity to hear more about at the later board meeting this year when we do our San Diego Bay updates. So I'll be doing that on the 14th. I understand I will be presented with an award of some sort on May 13th at that conference. I'll report on that if it happens subsequently. And also, with regard to the comments that were offered a few moments ago by Coastkeeper, I can update the board in terms of what's in the written report as well. First of all, the Tijuana River Valley Recovery Team, which continues to meet, we met twice on these subjects in March and then again in April. The City of San Diego and the County of San Diego are working together with us on this. I would point out that for any substantial work to take place down there, there's going to be both county permits, city permits, CEQA issues that will have to be addressed, as well as design. None of those berms that were installed were ever properly designed. They were erected by property owners and not maintained thereafter. However, there is some good news to report. The legislature authorized money under Senate Bill 170 for local projects, and among the projects that we recommended the State Board fund, in which they did fund, is $4.25 million for a sediment basin and trash boom in Smuggler's Gulch to try to prevent and control these types of flows and future rain events. That money also includes cleanup of the pilot channel in Smuggler's Gulch, so the accumulated sediment there can be removed, and that was probably going to be at least an initial step on an emergency remedial measure for the berm that was breached there in Smuggler's Gulch. You have photographs both in our report and that were submitted for item number 3 that show the extent of the flooding that occurred during the storm events there. The County of San Diego also received from that same source $2 million for the Brown property habitat and hydrology restoration. That property is immediately upstream of the confluence of Smuggler's Gulch in the south arm of the Tijuana River, and improving hydrology there is intended to reduce the impounding of water there, standing water that's frequently quite smelly, but also opening up the south part of the floodplain as was always envisioned in the recovery strategy so that the river could make full use of its floodplain rather than just be restricted to the northern arm. This is, again, another reason why doing something there right is more important than doing it fast, especially now that we have the dry season and the nesting season upon us, because we don't want to continue to exacerbate the flooding of the campground or private properties there. So the hydrology needs to be updated to address that. But we will be meeting with them. And in fact, yesterday, the International Boundary and Water Commission convened a Minute 320 work group on sediment issues. This subject came up there as well. The Water Board has several levers to turn with the city, county of San Diego, and others, and we'll be exercising those. I sent staff to that meeting yesterday. So I'll have more to report on that during the coming year on that effort. City and county were also represented at that as well. Also, unfortunately, I do have to share with you the news you may already have seen on the news that the Caulerpa prolifera outbreak in the Coronado Cays has expanded beyond the initial zone of control. It is now in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife waters outside the Cays themselves. We are aggressively investigating with the Port of San Diego, City of San Diego County, or City of Coronado, rather, the member agencies of the Southern California Caulerpa Action Team, or SCAT, in an inelegant acronym, but it goes back to the early 2000s. That team had already been activated for a similar outbreak up in Huntington Harbor, and this board was able to request and receive $500,000 to facilitate the investigation and control work. I did a news interview. We did a press conference, as the Department of Interior has provided additional funding for that. So we are hopeful that we will provide more updates and that those updates will be substantive and that we're able to get this prolifera outbreak under control. Otherwise, we really risk losing the key aquatic habitats, which are among the key beneficial uses that our practical visions identified for San Diego Bay. And when you lose those habitats that support the fisheries, you lose the organism's ability to feed in San Diego Bay, like seals and sea lions, pelicans and peregrine falcons who work up the food chain. So it really is necessary that we bend every effort to identify and control that outbreak. And hopefully it has not gotten much farther than it appears to right now. And then finally, the board adopted biological objectives for a basin plan amendment in December 2020. I'm very happy to share with you that we have a date right now for that item to be considered by the State Water Resources Control Board on September 17th of this year. Staff and I will be going to represent the board's basin planning amendment to the state board at that time. And unless there's any questions, that will conclude my report for this month.
You know, since we have a little extra time, which is so rare, if you could talk a little bit about when Caulerpa proliferates, what happens, how it works, and how it smothers and chokes out other nutrients.
Caulerpa, there are several species that are available as an ornamental algae for marine aquariums. Toxifolia was the one that broke out in the early 2000s in Agua Hediondo Lagoon, and prolifera is the one that has broken out at Coronado Cays in Huntington. They're still commercially available, and although if you go to the website, as I have yesterday, in fact, it says you can't ship it to California, but aquarium stores still have it, and although it's illegal in California, it's not a law that I see being enforced aggressively against aquarium owners or pet shops and so on. So it is out there, unfortunately. And what happens is that while it's under control in an aquarium indoors, people will sometimes dump their aquarium contents in the bay or a lagoon to free willy, as it were, perhaps, or because they just don't know what else to do with it. Well, that little bit of Caulerpa, even just a couple millimeters, is more than enough to reproduce the entire plant. And so as it breaks off in the environment, it spreads. It also produces runners, sort of like Bermuda grass, that spread out across the bay bottom. And the bay bottom there is relatively shallow, so there's potential for surface action to disrupt it, but it's also very murky, so it's very hard to see. And you have to literally do dives with divers, have to poke through the fine sediment very carefully so they don't cloud up the water and they miss it. It's very easy to miss otherwise, even though it's a bright fluorescent green. So it reproduces vegetatively, it sends out runners, it's very fast growing and very fast spreading. It has broken out in other parts of the world and never been controlled. We were fortunate to get ahead of it the several times it's come out in San Diego, our region, and in Region 8. Each of the 401 certifications that I review and sign under the authority delegated to me by you, the board, for peer replacements, for example, requires a Caulerpa surveillance. And fortunately, we had that in this case. There was a peer replacement project in the Coronado Cays. They did the survey, and fortunately, we found it. Unfortunately, we maybe didn't find it soon enough. So those surveillance efforts have paid off. So right now, the eradication method that they're using is simply to cover it up with a tarp and anchor it down to the bay bottom. That way it shades it out and kills it over time. In the early 2000s, we used tarps and chlorine to bleach it to death. Since then, they have found that the tarping alone will work and reduce the need to use liquid chlorine in the environment. So that's what they're doing right now. They've set out an extensive area of tarps in the Coronado Caves, and they're spotting and sending out additional tarps on all the locations where they find more of it. But it has the potential then to exclude eelgrass. It moves into the eelgrass habitat and displaces it. So eelgrass is no longer supported. It provides none of the benefits that eelgrass has. It's neither habitat nor food for any of the fish and shellfish and mammals that would otherwise utilize that habitat. So we lose the bay bottom. Even as we have a bright green bay bottom, it's not a bay bottom that supports the life that we would want to see in San Diego Bay. And I'll point out that the agencies, the Navy, the cities, the Port of San Diego, they've invested millions of dollars in eelgrass mitigation projects that are now at risk because of this invasive algae outbreak. So we could easily lose millions and millions of dollars of invested costs on creating this habitat. And of course, it doesn't help us with sea level rise either. So there are issues there with, and reasons why we want to get it under control. So we're very thankful that the administration in Washington sent out the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Department of Interior, Matt Strickland, to provide funding to continue our surveillance efforts. The Port of San Diego is one of the lead agencies. We're very glad to have them here today. And so we are hopeful that we can get ahead of this truly, even though it's farther spread now than we would like. And my message to the public in the interviews that I did was, even if you can buy it, don't buy it. And if you have it in your aquarium, please do not release it to the bay or any other place. Destroy it completely before disposing of it in the trash. So I'm hopeful that we're able to pass that word on to the public and eliminate the sales and the possession of Caulerpa species. But for right now, they're still very much available, and we'll continue to report our progress on the Bay efforts going forward.
Any questions? Yes, I do. I would like to talk about the sewer overflows, and I was wondering if we might be able to amend the tables that we get to also show, so they show us each event, and we get that every month that we meet. And I was wondering if we could have a running total for the agencies. So I don't know if you do it by the water year or if you do it by the calendar year, but it would just give us, like I noticed that one area had a very big spill, but I remember they also had a fairly big spill, but I couldn't remember how much, or, and it just might help. I don't know if that's very difficult.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. We do report them on a bi-monthly basis, and so I believe we have our own running total for agencies. I've seen that in the year's reports before, but we'll address your concerns in the upcoming drafts of the EOR.
Okay, thank you so much.
I guess I would just add one last thing. Those running totals, they're often early estimates or early declarations, mm-hmm. and they are sometimes revised as investigative orders are issued and additional investigation is conducted. Very frequently, the initial volume is corrected upwards or some cases downwards based on capture efforts and their efficacy in capture. So I think one concern I would have with having a running total is that the running total may be changing quite a lot during the course of a year, then that may seem to indicate better results and better progress when it's really just a data correction from initial estimates to final estimates subject to a penalty of perjury statement by a local agency where they actually quantify and then certify this was how much was spilled, this was how much was recovered. So I would treat those numbers with caution until they're properly certified case by case.
Perhaps they could be labeled tentative. Or estimated.
Yes.
I'm really interested in the ones that reach water.
Yes.
Not the ones that they collect all of it.
As are we indeed.
I know. That's clear.
So those SSOs are reported directly to the state, right? And they're entered in the CWICS database? Is it CWICS? I'm trying to remember.
There are several databases that we receive that information, but they submit an initial report, which might be an email or a phone call, and then follow it up with us as more information is generated. And we frequently respond with a notice of violation and or a 13267 technical report directive requiring them to submit quantified numbers for the spills and recoveries.
Uh-huh. But I'm wondering if it's CWICS, if those tables are manipulatable so we could accumulate them. I don't remember how much data manipulation you can do to slice and dice.
We are very fortunate to have Brandi Otwin-Beals here. I'm sad to announce probably for our very last board meeting for her.
Oh.
But I believe she has some information on that.
Well, congratulations on your move, I guess.
Thank you.
Woe is us.
I'll be retiring.
Ah, even better.
Thank you. And I get teary-eyed when I talk about it, so I'll try not to lose it on you. So my staff knows better how to manipulate CWIX than I do. But I do believe that information exists in CWIX and we should be able to download it pretty readily. So I'm already sending them an email letting them know that you like running totals specifically for the water that reaches surface water, or do you want running totals for everything?
I think the water that reaches surface water is most important.
Okay. And then running a 12-month running average.
Whichever you I don't know how what do you record it calendar year or do you record it water season to water season? I'm not exactly.
We just pull it from CWIX to provide the report to you. So it's easy enough to manipulate the data how you want to see it, how it's useful to you.
I think you can set dates. What you wanted it.
Yeah. Okay, or what we're, I mean, I can ask you offline too, but since I'm here, we're already providing you a 12-month running average, I mean, not average, 12-month running total on spills, so that might be the easiest thing to do, but we could try different things and get your feedback, and then we'll also work through, Dave, to make sure the information makes sense.
I didn't realize we got it quarterly, but I have seen the total, but it's just, in other words, if we start seeing fairly significant spills, then maybe we can't have Dave go sitting with everybody once a week, but maybe we can give them.
We're watching for that type of thing too. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big spills are being handled through enforcement actions. And then my team and I try to track if there's a frequency of spills. And then we'll issue notices of violation, information, orders, you know, and escalating enforcement consistent with the enforcement policy on that as well. So however you'd like to see the data, we're happy to bring it to you so long as that it makes sense.
And this may sound rather naive or fundamental, but what do you guys consider a big spill? I mean, is it 10,000 gallons, 100,000 gallons?
So the enforcement policy identifies what are significant spills. And so it could be a spill of any volume that reaches a Rec 1 water or a drinking water reservoir. So then volume doesn't matter. And then internally...
I was thinking about sewer, just the sewer spills.
Sewer spills. I am talking sewer spills, yes. And then... we typically have 50,000 gallons in mind, but circumstances matter. So if it was a smaller spill, but there was some negligence, we'll follow up on that. Or like routine pattern. I don't want to go too much into it without, I'm waiting for my attorney to say, Brandi, stop. But just to kind of give you an idea of, where I know we'll follow up.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much.
Speaking from a previous spiller, and anybody who operates a distribution system or grid system will have spills.
Yes.
Sometimes they're just little burps, and sometimes they're, unfortunately, larger spills. But it seems to me the proof is how well they contain it. So, pipes break, people drill into your pipes, all kinds of things happen. But if you have a good response and you can contain it, clean it up, suck it up with a vac truck and, do all the BMPs and are able to keep it from going into a rec run or any other important water body, it's less important to me how big the spill was, but how effectively they were and responsive and quick in mitigating it. So.
I think that's very true. And then looking for a pattern of spills as well. Are they maintaining their system? Do they have an adequate CIP project plan? And then the other thing that may not be obvious when you get these running totals are the people who, the non-reporters. And that's a challenge for us. We don't know who's just not reporting spills. So kind of keep that in mind when you see the running total, that it might be right or it might be wrong, because we don't think everyone reports. But unless you catch a sewer spill in action, it's hard to catch them not reporting.
Do you have an estimate of what percentage of either entities or gallons are not reported annually?
No.
Yeah, there's no way to.
I think it's a statewide problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, any more questions on sanitary sewer overflows? Okay.
Thank you.
So it is 9:30. Do we have an update of the commissioner's phone call? I mean, she's obviously not here, so I know she's going to run down as soon as she's available. Yeah, why don't we take a break until she's able to join us?
I think so. We'll take
a indetermined break, but it might be 5 minutes and it might be 10 minutes. Is in the room, so would everyone please take their seats? We're now going to hear an update from the United States section of the International Border and Water Commission on the time schedule order number Regional Board 9-2023-0189, compliance for discharges from the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant to the Pacific Ocean through the South Bay Ocean Outfall. We're very fortunate to have with us today Commissioner Maria Elena Hinar, who will give us a presentation and bring us up to date on all the details. Are you ready? We didn't give you much of a chance to settle in. And do we have her presentation queued up? Okay.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for bringing a bigger screen, because the last time I was here, if I recall, it was a little television that I had a real hard time reading some of the numbers that were on there. So I really appreciate that. Well, as they bring up the presentation, I'm really grateful to be here to be able to tell you personally all of the activities that have been going on and all of the fronts that we have been working on for I think I was here about 9 months ago. I know I was here in November, if I'm not mistaken, but I know Morgan was here in December to update the group. And the other thing is, I also want to thank the staff of the Regional Water Quality Control Board, because we've been having weekly meetings with them. And I know it's very time consuming for them as part of our time schedule order to ensure that we're meeting the thresholds and holding ourselves accountable to meeting the requirements to get our plant back in compliance. And like I stated the first time I was here and at every public meeting that I've been to, what has been happening has been unacceptable. Having the beaches closed for so many days, having this public health risks going on because of the situation with improperly treated or no treated wastewater is not acceptable to me as this head of this organization. I had the opportunity to update the governor as well, Governor Newsom up in Washington, D.C., and I wanted him to walk away with one overarching message, is that I am intimately involved and every single aspect of every single word and every single activity related to this. I'm intimately involved. We have great staff that has been helping with this. And I want you to walk away knowing that I'm not delegating this. And because of that, we are showing progress. And so if we could go to the next slide, that'd be great. So what I'm going to talk about today is what is going on with the permit, with the repairs of the plant to have our plant compliant. what's the update on the rehabilitation and the expansion? And of course, there's two very elements that are very important is we have 2 minutes, which are agreements with Mexico. That's the tool that this agency has to make these agreements with Mexico, minutes 320 and minutes 328. But first, let me talk about and just remind everybody kind of what the problem is. Let's go to the next slide, please. Or do I have, I have all this. Oh my goodness. Okay. So many of you have seen me use this cartoon or this illustration. We basically have two issues happening. We've got dry weather flows in the Tijuana River that are flowing into the Imperial Beach. And these dry weather flows have been happening every day since July 30th of 2022, and I'll let you know why in a moment. But these dry weather flows include treated wastewater from the two plants upstream, San Antonio de los Buenos and La Morita and Arturo Herrera. It's also untreated sewage from Tijuana, as well as spring flows. The other issue that is going on is a malfunctioning, non-functioning San Antonio de los Buenos wastewater treatment plant. And there are seasonally northern flows that go up to the beaches of Imperial Beach. And of course, this is contributes to the beach closures combined with the constant flow that we've had in the river. The other pieces of infrastructure that we've had issues with, which are included in our time schedule is Junction Box 1. Junction Box 1 is a 96-inch valve that had not been working for years. And my first experience with that was in December of 2021, a few months after I started, where we were having all of this no flow into the plant and all of the sewage backing up. And so at that point, I was informed that it had been frozen in place for years at 12 inches and it had plugged up. So that was another issue that we had. The other issues that are happening in Mexico, of course, as I mentioned, was the malfunctioning wastewater treatment plant. The international collector, this collector is critical to delivering flows from the river, as well as the collapse of Pipeline 1A, which also delivers flows from the river to Punta Bandera and into the ocean. Let's go to the next one. Oh, I have it. I keep thinking. How do I do this? Oh, there we go. Okay. I wanted to show this because this is what happened July 31st, 2022, where we have the collapse of two transmission lines, wastewater transmission lines that take water to Punta Bandera. One of them was fixed within about 2 weeks, and the other one has just been recently repaired, but has not really been put into use because it was repaired in December of this last year. And then we got into the wet weather. We've had an extreme wet weather this year. But I wanted to remind the group that I'm cautiously optimistic because right here we have transboundary flows. We have gauging stations that measure transboundary flows. And these are the transboundary flows in the Tijuana River between April 1st of 2022 through July 31st when the line ruptured. And why is that important? Because there was another work that was done, which was a lift station was rehabilitated in Mexico that December, and so of 2021. So we were able to take advantage of that new infrastructure plus functioning parallel lines that were working where we had almost no transboundary flows in the river. And so we have some spikes here because we had rain, but the loss of this PB1A, this line, a 42-inch line, has been really the huge impact to having flows in the river during the dry weather season. And I'm sorry, I don't think this works. Yes, okay. So this is another slide that I like to use that precisely shows how in 2020 Three, we had such large transboundary flows. 2024, we're continuing to follow those trends. But because of our, why are we here? Well, not only have we had excess flows, but we've really had some serious permit exceedances about, you know, half of the water quality parameters we have not been meeting. And that's why we're doing all of the repairs that we're working on. If I could see the next one, please. The next slide. The previous one. It was one extra. Yes, this one. This one's a new slide that we created because we wanted to kind of show the history of dry weather flows, transboundary flows. The blue, the dark blue, are the transboundary flows that have occurred back since 2004. So again, we have metering stations, and there are times when we've had no transboundary flows during the dry weather. And you can see here in 2023, the large amount of rainwater that we had, right, that obviously impacts during wet weather. But again, we've had larger than normal dry weather flows, and that's what we're working to reduce. And all of this work is moving in that direction. Here you also have the millions of gallons of flows that have come through the dry weather. And you can see in 2023, it was pretty much very large, as you know, compared to 2010 as well, was another large year. And again, 2010 had a lot of rainwater as well. So let's go to the next one, please. So why is our, what is happening with our plant? Many of you have toured our plant. Oh, one back. Many of you have toured our plant. Previous, the other direction. That's okay. Yeah, and I can't figure out the click. Okay. So this is our primary sedimentation tanks. We are growing tomatoes in them because they're not working. There's so much sludge in there, right? Our influent pumps also were down to one pump. We had the flooding during Tropical Storm Hillary when I was here, and I talked about that. That filled up our bar screen, so we got rags and dirt and sediment. And so that really tore up a really already vulnerable plant. So you're saying with this I can control it?
Can somebody help?
Oh, there we go.
The commissioner to show, let's make sure this thing works.
That's perfect. Okay. So because of having a vulnerable plant, because of the fact that we had the tropical storm Hillary, this plant, as I mentioned before, between 2010 and 2020, had only about $4 million worth of investment. And for a plant this size, that is not a lot to maintain it. In FY21, we had about $6 million in there, and we redirected another $31 million to repair the plant, to repair JB1, and to also clean out some of the issues that are going on. And so most of these funds, of the $31 million that were redirected, which are going to be now a total of $37 million except invested in this plant, most of it is from our 22 fund, from our 23 fund, and now our 24 fund. And so that's why we have such an aggressive schedule to meet our NPDES permit by August of this year from a water quality standpoint. So these are the ongoing repairs that we did. So we just not go far enough just to get things running. And what you see here are what the issues are in every one of the stages of our plant. What the issue is, where we're at now, what's pending, and how we're building redundancy. So if we do have another tropical storm Hillary, we're able to ensure that we have spare pumps. Spare pumps, you cannot go to Walmart and just pick them off the shelf. The delivery time for these is 7-12 months, you know, and so these are things that we have to source, we have to procure, and they have to be manufactured. And so what you're seeing here, like for instance, I think it went, did I do that? Oh, I'm still not done. What you see here is, if you can go back one slide, is that we're working on We have three of our six pumps already, influent pumps, working. We're waiting for two of our pumps, and we're going to have three spare pumps, you know, in case they do not work. Our primary sedimentation tank, I think this is the big issue that we've had. We had zero working. We have now one that's operational. We're working on cleaning the others. And so we're working on getting the four remaining ones, or the three remaining ones, completed by July of 2024. That's what we need to have operational in order to meet our permit. And our fifth one will be the resiliency we're building into this. Our activated sludge tanks, again, we only had one working. One of our waste activated sludge pumps working. Now we have two working, but we're going to have five spares so that we ensure that we have them working at all times. Going into our primary non-potable pumps, and again, you know, we've got what the issue, we had zero working. We have two of them working now. We're waiting for four more pumps to arrive. So again, two spares that we're going to have. In our secondary non-potable pumps, we only had one of the five working. We now have three working, and we have pending five pumps so that we can have three spare pumps. And then in our unstabilized sludge storage tanks, we only had one working. We have two of them working. We're pending six new pumps so we could have three spare pumps. Again, ensuring that we have what we need in order so that Veolia can act quickly should we have another similar situation like Hillary. So one of the also issues that we hear a lot about is the Hollister pump station, the smells. That area where the Hollister pump station is really, I think, affects a lot of the residents. And so we had zero of those pumps working after Hillary. We now have three of the four operational. We're pending two new pumps again, so we could have a spare. And the other issue that we're also having is the sediment and the flows that are still coming through the canyons. We are still, right now, we're working on certain canyons that don't have flows. We're starting to clean them out. I believe it's Smuggler's the one that needs to be cleaned out. And right now we're getting, no, it's Goats. I'm sorry. Goats is the one that's no longer having flows. We're cleaning that one out. We're starting to clean out our pump station, Hollister pump station. But to be quite frank, one of the issues that we're having is sediment coming from Mexico because of the double-decker highway that's being built. And so that sediment is clogging our canyon collector, so we can't get that flow out. So what are we doing to do that? What are we working towards to get that done? We're working with Mexico on identifying what the source is. Right now, we suspect is that source of this flow is related to some pumps that are not working in Mexico. It's bringing that sediment from the clearing of the foliage that was done when double-decker is in construction right now. We had a meeting with Sedena. Sedena is the military branch of the Mexican government that is building these highway, is doing a lot of construction. We had a meeting with them to talk about San Antonio de los Buenos, but also to talk about the sediment issues that we're having. And they're intending on putting in erosion control when that is done, which is October of 2024, and also at looking at revegetating the area. We're having discussions with other federal agencies to see what we could do to help to ensure that revegetation is done, because that will be critical for the erosion control. So even though they've made this commitment, and of course, given the fact that we're going to have erosion control measures such as sediment traps, the city of Tijuana is going to have to maintain that. And so we're also looking at having those conversations with the city about that maintenance. And that'll be something that we'll have to be doing ongoing on a permanent basis. So that is what we're doing on repairing our plant. Now, what are we doing for JB1? So here we have a schedule on JB1. Why is JB1 important? It is our only tool we have to throttle back flow into Mexico. so that we meet our compliance order with regards to excess flows, okay, or a permit regarding excess flows. The operations of the sedimentation tanks by July will help us meet the piece related to water quality, but we will still have issues of excess flows if we don't get this JB1 up and operating. And that is part of our TSO. And right now we have just received our 60% design. We envision starting construction in July. So we will definitely let you know, have a big celebration of this, because this has been a very difficult project because of the fact that we're painting the plane while we're flying it. We are still using that air. We are still using that area. What we did was we raised the valve or the gate and locked it in place because we had the risk of it falling and just shutting off all of our flow. So, but we don't have the ability to throttle back, and that is really an important piece. So with that, with this final project in February of 2025, we will have met all of our commitments within the time schedule order. And again, I'm really grateful to the time that your staff has provided to us on a weekly basis, because things happen. Things happen where we don't get equipment as planned. Things happen that when we start cleaning out a sedimentation basin, things don't work exactly as we imagined, or we find other things that are wrong. And so we've really been grateful for that ongoing conversation, so we can say, yes, we have this issue. Let's strategize. We call it riffing on solutions for some of these things, right? And so their expertise has been really helpful as well. Okay. So I'm not going to go into every one of these bullets here, but I did want to show we have in blue all of the ongoing activities related to the permit compliance, which started in July of 2022, as well as all of the activities related to USMCA. And if we can just, you can look at this at your leisure, but there's a lot of stuff going on. Let's go to the next one. And again, more activities. You can see here the realignment of funds as we've gone through this, the pre-solicitation of South Bay, getting in the supplemental, the $310 million, which still has not been approved, but it is still in the supplemental, was really a really big push. Let's go to the next one, please. But since our last meeting, since the last time I was here, which was back in, I don't remember if it was October, we went out and we kicked off JB1. PBCLA has been repaired. We started the procurement of the expansion. And then here we have what's coming in the future. And with the idea of finally meeting all of our time schedule with JB1 in February of 2025. But again, I do want to highlight that in August, we are envisioning meeting the water quality piece in August of this year. So, rehabilitation and expansion of the plant. There's been a lot of activity with regards to that. There was two big hurdles that we accomplished since we last spoke. One is we issued a contract for progressive design build. This is not something typical of the federal government. They do design, bid, build. They've started to get into other types of design build where you have multiple contracts out, but the progressive design build is very typical of what municipalities use for wastewater infrastructure. So we felt fairly comfortable that would be a path forward to shorten the time frame, significantly shorten the time frame. The other hurdle that we also accomplished was that when we went out for procurement, we got 5 bids, which is good. And so and what you see here, we went out for procurement December 8th. We received 5 bids February 8th, and we narrowed down the pool to 3, We did more confidential meetings. We did a confidential tour with each one of them. And we're expecting to get their bids with cost. The first one was qualifications. Now we're moving on to actual costs June 11th with the idea of awarding by mid-August. After we award, we will go into this design build era. Now, one of the questions that I frequently get is, when is it going to be done? It's really difficult for us to put a date on it because progressive design build is you're designing and you're building at the same time. And the relationships between the designer and the constructor can be a designer as a prime and a constructor as a sub, or a constructor as a prime and a designer as a sub. And they work together to build a schedule based on availability of equipment, based on availability of materials. And so one of the things they're going to give us is a schedule as part of their one of their deliverables. That's one. The other thing is that the contract includes funding both the designer and the contractor at the same time, so that they're working together and you don't have any delays and startups. So once we get a schedule from the selected consultant, we will be in a position to share it publicly. The other thing that we're also working on, and it's no secret, we have a small staff. We have a small construction staff. So back in December, in October, we hired Arcadis to do our condition assessment, but also to help us manage this program, manage it as a program. 300, when at that time, between 2010 and 2022, this agency was getting $31 million on average for construction for the entire border. Having $300 million come in is obviously we weren't going to be able to manage it with the resources we have right now. So we hired Arcadis to help us with this process. And so we are negotiating in parallel two program support contracts. One is with the Army Corps of Engineers to do quality assurance. And what they do is they take on the role. This is the first time I worked for the government, so I've learned all these new terms for the federal government, what they call inherently government responsibilities. So they will be taking on that role of helping us with those activities. And then we have Arcadis, which is going to be quality controlling the design bid construction firm. So we're working in parallel these two contracts. So we're working on three contracts at the same time so we can have a seamless process come mid-August to start moving forward. So what is this project? What is this contract we're going out with? So this contract includes final design of the entire project being a 50 MGD plant with 25 peaking factor. It includes the rehabilitation as well, all of the design of the rehabilitation. It also includes the construction of that entire project, but we don't know what we can construct right now quite yet. Right now, we bid the project out in phases, and we bid out a base project of the full design, the full rehabilitation, and a 45 MGD with the phase one, which is expansion to the target 50 MGD, and a phase two of a peaking factor of up to 75 MGD. As we get funding available, and depending on what this procurement is, we will be able to say we can fund the base project in phase one, or just the base project. Or if we get, you know, the supplemental base project, phase one, phase two, okay? So right now, we have more funding that we received. It's been no secret, we got an additional $103 million, and we're really grateful to the entire congressional delegation in this region because it was a very heavy lift. We also had other members of Congress who also supported this effort because they realized that having, on average, between 2010 and 2022 or 21, no, 22, Yeah, 2021. An average of $31 million for construction for the entire border is why we have the problems we have today. Okay. And what you see here in this one, just to remind the group, this was the condition, the results of the condition assessment of our plant. And what we have to address are number fours and fives. That's a lot of red and orange up there. But why? Because of the fact that now we didn't have that funding, and now we have more funding to work with. Let's go to the next one. So what's another item that's in our time schedule order? It is part of minute 320 as well, is our Tijuana River Valley monitoring program. This is something, now that we have an FY24 budget, we will be funding with FY24 funds. We did submit, based on feedback that we got from the work groups in minute 320, we did get a scope developed. We just got our comments from the Regional Water Quality Control Board. We're going to be integrating those comments, and we'll be putting it out for procurement as soon as we can get that scope finalized. But it will be this year. Okay, so I'm happy to announce that as well. So those are additional resources that are coming to the region. And just for people's edification, what this Tijuana River Valley Monitoring Program is to look at water quality issues in the canyons and in the river, so that we can have science to really understand what's going on in those areas. And so that will work with the SCRIPT study that's been done of what's the water quality issues in the ocean. Let's go to the next one. Okay. So minute 328 update. The other thing before, you can leave the slide there, but the other thing that I do want to highlight on minute 320 is that we had a really good meeting on minute 320 not too long ago in Tijuana, and we have identified some really concrete projects that will help to address transboundary flows, sediment, and trash. One of the ones that I think is really low-hanging fruit is that Mexico has a lot of designs of stormwater management, but what they don't have is a study to prioritize that stormwater management. And so that's really like a low-cost item that we're looking to see if we can get some philanthropy interested in funding some of this. And why is that? In Mexico, it's easier to get construction dollars than it is to get study money. And so study money is very low cost, $100,000, $200,000, to really have a big impact on what could be actually prioritized and really have a benefit in transboundary flows. So that's kind of the type of projects. We identified about five projects that could move forward, and now we're going into looking for financing or funding that could help with those projects. On minute 328, if you could go back to the other slide. Okay, minute 328 was an agreement that we signed between the United States and Mexico and went into force in August of 2022. Minute 328 committed Mexico to $144 million of investment. One more slide, please. $144 million of investment. It is really encouraging that Mexico has been able to get 50% of that funding allocated already. That was intended to be a five-year plan. That five-year plan was intended to be implemented as soon as you got construction dollars. In Mexico, there's no carryover of construction dollars from year to year. You use it or you lose it. So it's of no value to have Mexico have $144 million now, because it would be scraped back or carved back immediately if it wasn't implemented. So this is a really good sign that we have that amount of funding. And what you see here is one of those projects that I showed on the map. That's the International Collector. That International Collector started construction in August of 2023. And it will be completed in September of 2024. That international collector is key to being able to get waste or flows from the Tijuana River out into Punta Bandera. So that is advancing very well. It's one of the EPA-funded projects. I think they ended up funding 100% of it in Mexico. But the whole point is that this is advancing as expected. Let's go to one more. Now, this is the big one, San Antonio de los Buenos. San Antonio de los Buenos is one of the main reasons why we have those seasonal northern flows that have closed, especially the southern part of the Imperial Beach, but have actually made it quite further up the beach and you know, has impacted the beaches in the summer. And this plant will treat about one third of Tijuana's wastewater. And so Mexico has already received the funds. They started construction in January of 2024 with Sedena, the military arm of the Mexican government. They anticipate Sedena, you know, the official schedule that they're working under is to have it done by October of 2024. There's a lot of big variables to get it done by then. We feel very good that they will get the civil works done. Because that's being done with internal resources, with their, you know, they have access to all of the materials. But where their challenges will be is on the mechanical piece of it, the pumps. And because we know we struggle to get the pumps, we're not real confident that they're going to get it done by October, as they've optimistically, you know, stated. But the equipment is ordered and it's advancing and the funds have been assigned. Will there be enough funds? We don't know. But at least some advancement is there. And should we determine that there's not enough funds, then we can start again our negotiations with the Mexican government. We in Minute 328 had $300 million to expand South Bay. And we've obviously seen now it, you know, went up to $600 million because of the fact that not only did we have rehabilitation, there were some elements that were not budgeted appropriately, but now we have more engineering and know that we have more certainty in cost than we had before. But I do wanna highlight that it is advancing, and we did agree. You can see a picture there on the top where we had a meeting, and we did agree to have meetings every couple of months at a very high level there to talk about the advancements. We provide our advancements on our plant. They provide their advancements as well as the advancements on Minute 328 overall. Let's go to the next slide. This is a table that's put together that's used on a regular basis. And these are all of the works identified in the minute that have the status. What's pending funding is, like I said, we were talking about half of the project costs are still pending funding, but there's a lot of activity. Like you said, you see there, rehabilitation of PVC is 100%, rehabilitation of PB1. The pump is ongoing. We can go to the next one. We also have ongoing on a study that the NAD Bank is doing on what to do with La Morita and Arturo Herrera effluent that goes into the Tijuana River, which I've been told is about anywhere between half to 75% of the flows in the river right now. So it's really important to get that flow out, as well as we've got rehabilitation of the PB, the pump stations in Matadero and Laureles, which are related, which are equivalent of goats and Smuggler's Gulch. Okay, let's go to the next one. Okay, so a lot of information that I gave. I always like people, you know, they say what you're going to say it, and then say what you said, right? And this is what I call my highlight slide, where I talked about IBWC is working on multiple fronts. We're working on ongoing repairs for the permit. We're working on rehabilitation and expansion, as well as minutes 320 and 328. But these are the highlights on our permit compliance. South Bay repairs are well underway. JB1 is on its way. The Tijuana River Monitoring Plan scope of work is nearing completion and envisioning implementing fall 2024. And those are in our TSO. Rehabilitation and expansion on its way. We're awarding the progressive design build, getting the support contracts that we need from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, as well as the support program support that we need from our technical engineering consultants. Minute 328 is on its way. So transboundary flows, pipeline PB1A, the one that broke, is ready for operation. We have not tested it. So I'm cautiously optimistic. We being the Mexican government, right? Because it is on the US, on the Mexican side. So we are waiting for the flows to be reduced to about 40 MGD in the river before we can start cleaning them out, cleaning out the pump, cleaning out the area around it, so that we can start taking flow and get it out of the river and rebuild that berm that held all the flows back, like I showed in that first graph, between, you know, April 22 to July 31st, which is a dry season, of getting back to those levels in the Tijuana River. Go to the next one. So I do want to highlight a couple of things that we're really proud of that don't have to do with our time schedule order, but really the Tijuana River North Levee cleanup. As many of you saw, there was a lot in the paper with regards to all of the trash that got built up there because of Hillary storm. And we removed 79 drumsters. It's beautiful. It's probably better than it's ever been before. And we're looking at finishing this cleanup in 2 weeks. We brought staff from South Texas, and we brought, which you have not seen the heat down there. They are happy campers out here. So we brought staff from South Texas. We brought our equipment. We are leaving some equipment here permanently to have it available so that we can continue to clean this area more quickly now that we have these resources there. And we have about 2 weeks left to clean up for a full cleanup. I invite you all to go see it because it looks phenomenal. Let's go to the next one. The Tijuana River diversion. This is one of the things that has been brought up by the community as being important. And in many public meetings that I've been to, including with the city of Imperial Beach at our Citizens Forum, I have been very transparent that the federal government does not take on new infrastructure very lightly. And so to get to that point, I feel we have to understand what are the implications of having a Tijuana River diversion project? What are the risks? What exactly is the community asking for? What are the costs? So we are going to be scheduling a series of focus group meetings starting in July to talk with stakeholders and officials on what their expectations are. Is zero transboundary flow during wet weather what people are looking for? Well, that's probably unattainable. Is it 10%? Is it only during certain periods? Is it trying to capture 50% of it? Those are the conversations we want to have. We also are going to identify what's the information that's available to date by the scripts, by the previous studies, bring it all together so that we all are starting from the same point of knowledge. And then we will take these ideas from the community and build a scope and go out for procurement. The request for proposals, we're envisioning this study will include technical, financial, the permitting, legal, and environmental issues that will need to be addressed with this. And at that point, collectively, a decision can be made how to advance this infrastructure. We'll have regular update meetings on this as we go through this process. So I know this infrastructure is really important to the community, and I want to assure them that we have not dropped the ball on that one either. And I believe that's my last slide.
Thank you. I believe we'll have questions for you.
Of course.
We appreciate you making this available in your presentation. And who would like to start the questions? Dr. Olson.
I would like to ask you a question about Pipe 1A. So it is now completed.
Correct.
You have not tested it. What is the estimated time period that you think you'll be able to test it? And then what date do you think it'll be operational?
Okay. So There's a couple of things that we're working on right now. One is the testing phase will be probably several weeks. And why? Because we have to see as we start pressuring it up, mm-hmm. if other things are breaking, right? So if nothing breaks, it'll be operational. If certain things break, then there'll be other repairs that would need to be done. So there's some variables that are going on. But there's a little bit of some stuff in between too. There are ways to detect whether there's sensitivities to pipe going on as you're pressurizing. So at that point, we may have to determine that this is the only capacity we can get out of that. So we'll have to weigh the benefit of going 100% versus going partial operation versus going 100% stopping operation and doing the repairs. So if it's a repair of one day or 10 days, it may be worth it. But if it's a repair of months, it may not be worth it. So
this is a force main.
It's
right?
A force main, correct. Okay.
So if you had to pump it, which actually in California metropolitan water districts having a problem with the pipe and they're having to pump it at reduced flow. So can you tell me what, when can you inform us what you think that will be?
So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that by the end of this month, we would, right now the flow in the river is about 60 to 65 MGD. Mm-hmm. We have a protocol that we have to get down to 45 MGD before we clean it out. And I'm hopeful that by the end of this month, we will have reached that threshold and can start this process. We'd be in the weekly meetings that we have with Dave Gibson, we can be informing, we could add that to the agenda to ensure that he is knowledgeable as far as how that is advancing so that he can inform you, Dr. Olson, and the board. Is that helpful?
That is very helpful for me, okay. Because I know with construction, there are always delays.
Right. Right.
Almost always. So the other question I had was, you're going to, and these are sort of detailed. So the impact, let me go back to this 1A pipe. The impact will be what in the summer if it can't work above, let's say it could work at 25%.
Right.
Capacity. What would be the impact coming out of the Tijuana River that could affect Imperial Beach and beaches
right.
north?
So we'd have to go back and take a look at that because that period of time that we were collecting flow and we had no transboundary flows, it doesn't necessarily mean we were at 100% use of the pipe. So let us go back and look at some, I think that's a great suggestion now that you made the suggestion, is that a little bit of a risk analysis, right? So that we are in prepared to make those decisions should we see we only need 25% capacity of this pipe. So we'll go back and take a look at those months and we can share that with the executive director Gibson and let him know what we're seeing in terms of maybe we don't need the full 100% of the pipe.
Okay, then the other
Dr. Olson, before you move on,
sure.
On the same topic, I have a question
sure.
on PBC.
Go ahead, please.
PB Avila. This was completed many weeks ago. I remember the excitement I felt when it
right.
was announced.
Right.
And so there's been a tremendous delay. And I was wondering if you could tell us what that was about.
Right. So it was completed in November, December. It was completed in November. In December, they started testing it. But then the amount of rain that has been coming since December, January, February, and March has exceeded the 45 MGD protocol. And so when it's that much water, it'll cause too much damage to the infrastructure to get it out. It's not a river diversion project. It's just a pump to get water that generally is treated wastewater, spring water, and not a little bit of maybe 10 to 15% wastewater, right? So it's very diluted, but when it's raining, it has sediment, it has trash, it has rags, it has all kinds of things that you don't want to damage this lift station with. Is that helpful?
Absolutely, thank you. I never heard that before. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, no, that was useful.
And that's why we always talk about dry weather flow.
Okay, so my other question was, you're going to get the cost for the progressive design build, you think, in June 11th. And then you're making the award. So, and it's going to start construction in mid-August. Do I have that wrong?
A little bit.
Yes, good. Well, okay. Correct me, please.
Okay, so... It's going to start what they call progressive design build. So in mid-August, they may not start construction, but again, it depends on what schedule they gave us. So what are the early works that could be done? But one of the early works that could be done is start to do site grading, right? So not necessarily construction is going to start in August, but it could start months after that because they're doing design and construction at the same time.
Okay, so you have to grade the site.
Right.
All right. And so you don't...
So they could start, like, for instance, normally a process like this would be 18 months to 2 years to design, 9 months to bid out for construction, 3 to 4 years to build. But this is doing it all at the same time, and we avoid the 9 months of a new procurement process. The design and the construction is going on at the same time, and they're ordering equipment at the same time.
So one of the problems that I heard about earlier this year was a plant that was designed, and then they found out that they didn't have enough strength in the soil to be able to proceed, so they had to do mixing and cement. And it also was close to a river, and this site is close to a river. So are you anticipating, I mean, how are the, are they, do they, as they do their design build, do they do their due diligence before or after June 11th?
So there's some due diligence already done, because when we did the condition assessment, there was a geotechnical analysis that went in with that condition assessment. So when they did the condition assessment, they did some preliminary design. So there are plans. There are some plans that are available that were part of the procurement package that included some geotechnical work. So there is some thought and mitigation of risk with regards to that. But once we go into full design, then they'll be doing a lot more detailed geotechnical work as they're going through that. So in this case where you were talking about, they could have not had maybe enough geotechnical in there, or maybe they didn't have geotechnical engineering within it.
Okay, thank you. Now, could I go back to pipe 1A?
So of course.
If when you do your testing of pipe 1A and you find out that it has to have limited flow, and will you have enough money? Okay, so you can't do the repairs right now. I get that. Will you need the help of the water board to be able to approach in case you need more funds? Because it seems if we ask for the funds sooner.
Right.
Although you do have a problem that you can't carry any over. So that's really.
Right. So again, the degree of repair that would need to be made, Dr. Olson, will depend on what the request is. Definitely the advocacy of the water board is really useful. Definitely if there's an opportunity to bring down funds from the state or from philanthropy, that would be very beneficial that we could transfer to Mexico, because this is infrastructure that's in Mexico, right?
Yes.
And so that would be very beneficial. Our EPA partners are very much engaged in this as well. And so that is also what could be potentially beneficial as well. But definitely, I think Dr. Olson, let us get, give us a month, give us a month. And then at that point, hopefully we'll have more certainty as to what is the path forward. Well, first of all, diagnose what the problem is. I just want to warn the board that it may not be, you know, all, you know.
Sunshine and roses.
Yeah, I couldn't think of the word, right? Sunshine and roses, yes. Yes. And so give us a month. And then at that point, then we can strategize as far as what the needs are to overcome a problem that we can better define.
All I want to say is, I know this is true of the board and Dave, we just want to assist in any way we can to help the project go forward in a speedy manner. So the last thing I wanted to ask about was this junction box, because I may have misunderstood from an earlier report, but I thought that because the junction box was open all the way, it led to problems in the initial part of the screening process in the sewage treatment plant and led to the issues in the primary.
So
is that correct?
So partly correct. It's because we weren't able to throttle back flow.
Right. And right? It won't be until 2025.
Correct. Correct. But the works that Mexico is doing on their side will help keep that flow, so we're not exceeding our permitted flows. That's one thing. The other thing is that in the one of the things that we've recognized with how this our plant is operating is that there's really not a lot of upfront works that removes trash, debris, rags, sand, right? It is designed like a typical municipal wastewater treatment plant, but the volume that we get is way above what's normal. And so that is one of the considerations that is going to be thought of with the rehabilitation and the expansion of the new plant, is to ensure that. That's more along a little bit further out. But JB1 will not necessarily keep back the sediment and the trash and all of that. That right now is being scraped out manually through the Veolia contract.
So you have one that's suitable to put back into service, one primary.
Yes, right now it's operating right now, one of the sedimentation tanks.
And then, as I understood, I'm sorry, I asked really detailed questions because I'm trying to understand. For me, the most important thing is to try to get to a good place as soon as possible.
Right. And this primary sedimentation is going to be back in operation at full 100% by July of this year. And then it takes some testing and stabilizing to get to that August date that we're targeting. So July is our threshold of what we're working towards to get all the rest of the sedimentation tanks cleaned out. We've started to get all of our equipment that goes in there. And so that is half the battle, probably 75% of the battle.
Well, our executive officer does a really wonderful job in his executive summaries every month of what's going on at the plant. But it's been most helpful for you to come here today. I am quite worried about this junction box one but I guess it's not going to be done, and hopefully these other parts will come to fruition so it won't cause you additional problems.
Right, and just to add, on the Mexican side, the international collector, as well as the rehab of PB, the actual pump PB, is including some of this sediment retention technology within it. So that's also going to help us.
All right, well, that's very good. So I just want to end by saying, if you find that you're running late on any of these things, we'd appreciate you coming and telling us, because there's nothing like being able to hear it from you, because you are really doing all the work, and we want to say we greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Olson. No, without a doubt, I think between here and South Texas is where I spend most of my time, and I'm out here at least once a month. So without a doubt, if we're seeing we're running late, I will definitely be out here in June, July, when we start seeing some of these things going on. I'm actually going to be out here in June anyway for a meeting with the Mexican section on the status of San Antonio de los Buenos. So again, if you need me to inform the board, I'd be more than happy to do that.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
Excellent presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Olson.
Additional questions?
Thank you so much. That is an amazing presentation. Being new on this board, it was very helpful. I congratulate you again about the fact that you're able to do a design build program for this, because you're going to save a lot of time, as you said, and probably funding as well. I am a little confused in terms of the design build. You have phase one and phase two. Phase one is only going to be 50 MGD, and obviously the goal is to 75, and you mentioned having studies has been difficult. That helps a lot. Currently, the plant is at 45 MGD, so phase one only increased 5.
Okay, so our plant right now is 25 MGD, okay? And so we defined the phasing as a base project. Before we got this additional funding, we estimated that we could afford a base project of the design of the entire thing, upgrade to the rehab of the plant now, and an additional, I guess you would say, 20 MGD to bring it up to 45 MGD. And then as funding became available, the next phase would be an additional 5 MGD model, and then phasing out the peaking. The contract is for the entire thing, so we would not have to go out for procurement again. It's just as funding becomes available, we will be able to phase it out.
Thank you for clarifying that. That makes much more
sense. I'm glad. I'm going to update that on my slide, but thank you for letting me know.
If I may have one more following up question. The funding you're going to face as the plant age, or as you know, you have to have maintenance and things will break down within a year, whatever the case may be. Are the funding including any maintenance funding?
So at this time, no, because it's not built. But this is what we're doing right now. Last year, we funded a position and we contracted. Was it last year? Yeah, 23. We funded a position and we contracted a consultant to do an asset management system for us, a computerized asset management system. What we're trying to do is move from a reactive agency to a proactive agency. So you have a car. You buy a car, you have a plan, 5,000, 10,000 miles, right? We should have the same thing for each one of our pumps, for each one of our components, but the agency didn't even have an inventory of the components. So the condition assessment that we did on the plant is the basis of the components. So now we have everything inventoried, and as we're adding things, we update the maintenance plan for that component, right? And so right now, this year, the South Bay is the first one to go into that system. We're going to be buying a software. We're going to be, and so the idea is for us to be able to now roll up the costs with those maintenances and say in FY26, you're going to need to do this. In FY27, you need to do this. In 28, right? We get a lot of support from the members of Congress to up our construction budget, up our O&M budget, but they always say, how much do you need? And there are three things that we're working on right now. We just finished a manpower study to look at the needs of the agency from a staffing perspective, and we'll be coming out with that fairly soon. This asset management, which we are implementing in phases over like 3 years. But again, South Bay is going to be the first one in there. Our wastewater treatment plants are going to be the first ones in there. And then the other thing is a capital plan. We do not have a capital plan. We have a list of things that do not work, and how we're going to try and do as many as we can in the next 3 years based on what we think our funding is going to be. But the asset management plan, the capital plan, will help us prioritize where money needs to go. And so, right now I do it intuitively. Safety, number one, that's my first bucket. If it's a safety issue, that goes first. The second one is if it's just not working, that goes second. And the third item is you're on four spares, you got to wait, right? And so kind of triaging everything is how we've been doing it so far. But we don't have a capital plan that looks at how we need to really prioritize. Is that helpful?
Yes, very much.
You're doing a lot of catch up.
Yeah, this is catch up.
I just have a couple of quick questions. Obviously, that $310 million supplemental seems fairly important when you're looking at $600 million plus or minus 30%. Do you anticipate, what's the timing on hearing about that?
So obviously it was in the supplemental bill for this year. And I'm under the understanding that if it doesn't get approved, then it has to go through the process again with the new Congress, right? And so we have no information right now as to what Congress status is as far as the approval. It didn't get wrapped up into this foreign aid bill, that there was a possibility of it being wrapped up, not just South Bay, but other emergency funding related to other natural disasters that have been happening. So at this time, unfortunately, we don't know if it's going to be funded or any status on it, because it does not seem to be moving.
So without that, would we be able to successfully complete the base plan?
Yes. Without that, we do feel we can get the base project done. But again, we don't want to go too much time out without addition. We're going to need additional funding. This year we received $156 million. The year before that was $53 million for the entire border. It was a heavy lift to go from 53 to 156. And then before that, the average was $31 million for the entire border. So again, having a sustained amount of funding in our construction budget is going to be critical to maintain this facility, but also to fulfill our obligations under Minute 328 with Mexico. And if we want them to fulfill their obligations, we need to fulfill our obligations.
Critical.
Yes.
And then very quickly, just since you only have one sediment tank in operation right now, how full is that tank?
So it's a sedimentation tank.
Okay.
Where the sediment is taken out. So it's full. And so right now, well, before we had none working and they were all full, the wastewater was just going right through. So at least a portion of our wastewater is getting treatment now.
Going through that. Okay.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, I should know the answer to this, but just your JB1 valve, I understand the importance. It's to protect your system. Where does the water go when you close that?
So it's a question I've had internally as well, right? So it goes into the river. So we're weighing that balance, protecting the plant, having flow in the river, right? Really, the ideal thing is to get PB1A, the pipe, so that there's no flow in the river like we were before, right? I really think as we move into the design of the new plant, considerations for a bypass, so that do we want flow in the river or do we just put it into the outfall? Those are considerations that we'll have to discuss with the board, as well as with our consultant, as far as elements, so that we're not in that situation of, instead for protecting our plant, we're putting the wastewater in the river.
Yeah, I'm glad you're considering that, because it's a complex question.
It is.
It has a lot to do with the conditions. I mean, in a huge storm,
right?
Maybe that much extra water going in the river isn't going to make a difference, but in other conditions, it could be really important. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
You've been very creative in scraping together money that probably was allocated to other places, and we very much appreciate that. But clearly, you're falling short financially. And if we look long term, the maintenance question is always a really huge one. We don't want to repeat this again. I remember this whole process 20 years ago, And here we are again. And it was basically the lack of maintenance funds,
right,
which you've identified. And so since you've been there, we've seen increased investment and the potential of substantially more investment and great plans going forward. And it gives us hope that these deadlines in August will be met and we will actually see real progress. Because as you said yourself, the people in the community are very, very much impacted, and they are very tired of being impacted for so many years upon years. So we cannot do this fast enough.
Right. And we do try and announce on a regular basis on Twitter, as well as on, we issue out emails on a regular basis. If you're not, you know, Morgan can put you on our emails as far as advances that are being made, so that the community knows incremental steps are being made, right? And I wish, you know, I wish I could just go to sleep and just a magic wand and everything just all of a sudden is built. But it's a lot of work, a lot of attention to detail, a lot of advocacy on your part, and a lot of holding us accountable that has really, and then we have great staff. We've really staffed up the office. When I got here, there was only two people there. We have five people there, and we've also allocated two more people just focused on the plant, on the expansion and the rehabilitation. And so we are definitely bringing a lot of the resources that are needed for this area.
We appreciate that. And rest assured, we are going to keep you accountable, because that is our job. And we cannot do anything but that.
Right.
Before I call up Commissioner Dan Malcolm from the Port of San Diego, I want to give our staff an opportunity to have any comments or questions that you wish to say. I think I passed you by originally, Melissa Corona and our executive officer, Dave. Do you have anything to ask or add at this point? Okay. Dave.
Thank you, Chair Cantu. I think the commissioner has given you already enough information, perhaps more than we can digest easily. We will have her presentation and make it available. It's available to you right now. I don't have anything more to add, except that Melissa Corona will continue to meet with the International Boundary and Water Commission and Veolia and receive regular updates. And I do anticipate her being present in the room as the design build efforts are underway. Similar to the approach we took with the Pure Water Project and the Poseidon Desalination Project, having one of our engineers there makes it practicable and easier for us to get the right permit to the board for your consideration at the right time for that expansion to take place. The final thing, I'll just offer my own personal editorial view. I appreciate everything the commission and commissioner have done. My concern to the elected officials is that even a $600 million treatment plant, which is not yet funded, is still the economy model. Mm-hmm. It doesn't include sludge digestion, for example. Peak flows would only be 75 million gallons per day. But we easily saw topping of that during the last some storm events, not even just Tropical Storm Hillary. I think that there's an opportunity yet with the approach that IBWC is taking with the design build, and I really appreciate the phasing to augment that so that we do this job right for the next 50 years and not come back a few years from now frustrated that the design flows were not adequate and that sludge digestion wasn't included and redundancies in the plant weren't included. We have the opportunity now to do this right generationally,
right.
And I really appreciate the leadership of the commission and getting what they can out of the funding they've been provided, but just acknowledge that there's more that could be done on this facility to ensure its long-term progress. And then also wanted to thank the commissioner for the information on the river diversion system. The local agencies, and I believe you'll hear from the port commissioner in just a moment, we've long advocated for that as being the key component of a holistic or comprehensive approach. Without it, we really don't make the progress that we need to see for the future. So there are some real benefits on our work ahead. I think we'll see some real positive outcomes from addressing La Marita and Arturo Herrera flows. I understand from EPA, and they're present today if you have questions later on, that those flows are going to be diverted upstream of Rodriguez Reservoir to essentially become part of an indirect potable reuse approach. That serves two points that we always wanted to address with the record of decision. One was climate change resiliency through recycled water reuse, but also getting those flows out of the river, which, as the commissioner indicated, makes 50 to 75% of the daily flows during the summer. That makes it far more manageable for us to deal with those flows that do occur otherwise.
Right.
So thank you for the chance to just add in a few points. I appreciate your time today, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I hope you can continue staying at the meeting while we have the rest of the conference.
Of course.
Thank you.
Thank you.
San Diego Port Authority Commissioner Dan Malcolm.
Thank you, Chair Cantu and board members and Executive Officer Dave Gibson. I want to thank you for the opportunity for the Port of San Diego to speak here today. And I also want to thank you for providing that accountability, for providing that regulatory oversight for this very difficult situation. I am Dan Malcolm. I've been the Port Commissioner for Imperial Beach for 14 years. Before that, I was a city council member in Imperial Beach and actually was on the council in 1998 when the treatment plant first came online. So I've been with this and on this issue for a very, very long time. The Port of San Diego was established by the state of California to balance on state tidelands maritime industry, commerce, regulate public safety, and also we are environmental stewards of port tidelands. Now, those tidelands include 34 miles along San Diego Bay. They also include the beach and the water right up to Tijuana through Imperial Beach. And so that's the nexus for the reason why the Port of San Diego is so involved in this, our environmental stewardship and our environmental champion of the region and the people that we represent. So I want to say that I appreciate Commissioner Hienaar being here today and what she had to say. It doesn't change the fact, however, that we are dealing with a very dire public health and environmental health situation. I think just to be perfectly blunt, this is one of the most egregious clean water violations in the United States. It's number one right now. And I think second place isn't even close. And just to kind of back up that point, the beaches from Tijuana State Park to Imperial Beach have been closed 880 days. IBWC has documented 30 billion gallons since October of 2023. Of course, Hillary was a big part of that. But since 2018, it's been 100 billion gallons of raw sewage going down into the ocean. And that is just having a horrible effect. Now, there was a recent paper from San Diego State, a white paper that documented what was happening. And I am actually going to read a quote from the paper. I believe it's important to get this in the record. And this quote I'm reading was actually in bold script in the paper, indicating, I believe, that the authors wanted this to be highlighted in their paper. Quote, "The detected contaminants are a direct result of the transboundary sewage flows and are known to be persistent, bioaccumulative, carcinogenic, toxic, and can be resuspended in water and air during weather events in both wet and dry seasons, exposing nearby communities. Contaminated air from the nearby Tijuana River outflows can diffuse across the community of San Ysidro and Imperial Beach and enter homes, childcare centers, schools, and potentially increase the health risks of local community members without any direct water contact." Now, that's unquote. For the hundreds of thousands of people that I'm representing here today in Imperial Beach, in Otay Nestor, in San Ysidro, people that live within the smell that we are smelling in the down there, and I hate to bring it up that way, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, it's common sense. If you can smell it, you are breathing particulate matter into your lungs. It is a horrible, horrible situation. The report went on to note that 329 organic and inorganic compounds and chemicals were found in the water, in the sediment, things like DDT, PCBs, lead, arsenic, SARS-CoV-2, HIV, pneumonia, just a toxic list. 175 of these chemicals that were found are on the EPA Toxic Substances Act list. So just horrific what is going into our water. The report also documented that a sentinel species, the bottlenose dolphin, right offshore of Imperial Beach, are dying, and it is directly related to transboundary flow chemicals that are going into the marine environment, our sensitive marine habitats. So we know what we need to do. We've heard today the commissioner talk about, I believe euphemistically, the rehabilitation. What that really is deferred maintenance over years, that the plant was not maintained correctly. And I'm very appreciative of the commissioner's efforts and also of our congressional delegation to designate $103 million for that deferred maintenance. I'm not sure that's going to be enough. I'm not sure anyone really knows what the number is, quite frankly. I'm also I'm appreciative of the $300 million in the USMCA. However, that deferred maintenance has got to get done, and that plant has got to be rehabilitated in order for the solution, the upgrade, to even take place. That's got to happen first. In terms of the upgrade, we are thankful, and I like the design-build approach. However, when the EPA studied this, and there were many, 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 many public meetings, I was in all of them, we had the community chime in. We had all of the cities in the region chime in. And what everyone agreed of and what was in the notice or the record of decision for the EPA was a comprehensive solution. And comprehensive means comprehensive. It doesn't mean piecemeal. My point being that you can upgrade that plant and you can add 50 million gallons of capacity in the plant to treat Tijuana sewage. However, if you do not do the river diversion, we heard the question that you asked, Mr. Strawn, was a great question. Where does the water go when that pump is off? It goes right in the Tijuana River. So what we have is we have a plant that is going to be upgraded to treat sewage. However, we have a river a stone's throw away that is bringing these chemical contaminants right into the water. So without that diversion, we aren't solving the problem. We're going to be right back here year after year after year. So what my ask is that we prioritize the diversion along with the design build. There's money right now to start the entitlement process, to do the NEPA, to do the environmental review, to get this, a term we like, shovel ready, so that I and the commissioner and others can go to our congressional delegation, we can go to the president, and we can actually get the funds we need. It's a lot easier to say when you have something shovel ready and ready to go. So what I'm really advocating here is that the diversion has really got to be moved up. We don't need any more community meetings. We already know what the community thinks. That is just a way, quite frankly, respectfully, to just delay what has to happen and what is already in the record of decision. So that's the message that I want to leave here today. Again, I appreciate your attention to this. You know, we all know what's going on there. We have to listen to our scientists, to the people that are opining on what the situation is. We have to act. The time for action is now. I really appreciate the board's oversight on this. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. We'll now go to inviting our public speakers to share, and I'm going to call two people, and so we'll have a backup. The second person's on Zoom, so they can start being ready so we can move quickly. Our first person will be Patrick McDonald, who we heard from earlier on a different subject, and he will be followed by Leon Ben-Home, who is on Zoom.
Similar but related subject. Thank you, Chair Cantu and members of the board. My name is Patrick McDonald. I'm the senior attorney for San Diego Coastkeeper. I'll start by noting that we really are appreciative of the work that the IBWC has been putting into addressing these problems, upgrading its plants and infrastructure. You knew there'd be a but. Sorry. it's not enough. In light of what we've heard today and over the past few months, even before the adoption of the TSO, Coastkeeper continues to have very serious concerns that IBWC will not be able to meet effluent limitations nor comply with the terms of this TSO by August of this year. And in light of the substantial human and environmental risks at stake here, it's frankly unacceptable and a bit infuriating. This is one of the biggest if not the biggest ongoing environmental catastrophes in the United States. But I continue to hear a lot of doublespeak, strongly suggesting that this crisis will just continue. So first, as we've heard many times, even before the adoption of the TSO, the IBWC will not be able to meet the effluent limitations until JB1 is fixed, and it won't be fixed until 2025, yet IBWC continues to say, well, they'll meet effluent limitations in August of this year. We brought that up today. The commissioner's response was it's still relying on Mexican flows to reduce their sediment, again, by August of this year. I'm not really convinced by that answer. That's not an ironclad commitment that ensures compliance with this TSO. Second, there's continuing effluent limitations for chemicals like PCBs, DDT, toxaphene. Coast Keepers brought this up in prior meetings like December 18th. And this has been happening for well over 5 years. And IBWC's response was, oh, there's some staff turnover and software issues. For 5 years, forgive me, but it's things like this that also don't inspire a lot of confidence that IBWC will be able to come into compliance with this TSO and with their effluent limitations in a matter of just a few months. Moreover, Chair Cantu asked for an update on these exceedances / reporting errors on December 18th. But by the February board meeting, it was still not done yet. IBWC just said they're still working on it, and we've had no updates since that time. Meanwhile, in March of this year, the last quarterly report, that still shows exceedances for DDT and PCBs. So what's happening? And further still, despite IBWC stating on the record that the chemical exceedances, were all non-detect and only due to reporting errors, they also said, well, the treatment plant's not designed to remove heavy metals or chemicals like PCBs. So again, like that, IBWC seems to be speaking out of both sides of their mouth. Moreover, are we okay with PCBs and DDTs and benzidine and toxaphene just discharging into our waters? No, that's why there are effluent limitations in their permit to prevent that from happening. But until IBWC addresses these pollutants, it will remain in violation of the effluent limitations and the time schedule order. And then third, IBWC claims their plans are continuously hampered by sediment loading, which we understand and we see, but then also claims that they'll be able to comply with the TSO contingent upon reasonable flows of sediment from Mexico. Well, that's a huge contingency that has not happened in years. And sediment has caused all sorts of damage and emergency repairs, and you know, we sympathize with IBWC for that, but it's going to continue to happen. So what construction BMPs is Mexico implementing? There's plenty that they can do to minimize sediment during construction. And what is IBWC doing to apply pressure on SELA and on their Mexican counterparts to implement better sediment controls so that they ensure the sediment doesn't come through and then destroy all of IBC's new infrastructure, new pumps, and take us right back to where we were? So yes, a lot of this has to do with what's happening on the Mexican side of the border. However, it always has been, and it likely always will be. So we implore IBWC to engage with and apply as much pressure to SELA and their Mexican counterparts as possible for regular meetings with more vigor every week, every day if needed. This is a crisis, and it demands to be treated as such. Thank you for your time to comment today.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Leon Benholm is not available. Leslie Gallegos, followed by Sarah Davidson, both on Zoom. Is Mr. Gallegos available?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, good. Oh, it's Ms. Gallegos. I'm sorry, Leslie.
No worries.
Thank you. Welcome. Please proceed.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Leslie Gallegos. I live in the area between Imperial Beach and San Ysidro, and I've been heavily impacted by this crisis for all of my life. I understand that even if the IBWC fully complies with this TSO, it won't solve all of the environmental and human health impacts caused by the transboundary sewage flows. But I do urge that full compliance with this TSO is needed ASAP and is a very important step in the right direction. And I know the TSO only covers infrastructure owned by the IBWC and everything that is on this side of the border, but this should be the easiest problem to fix. Because what hope do I and my community have if they can't have this right? The IBWC is supposed to exist to protect my community and the environment, but they have a long history of failing to do so. And based on the latest updates, it seems like the IBWC is already slipping past some deadlines, and what we've seen in the past, how it happens every time, and they always have excuses. And I just want to ask the board, like, what will happen if IBWC fails to comply with these effluent limitations by August 15? And will the regional board hold them accountable, and how do you plan to do that? If the regional board allows any additional time, it would just be completely unacceptable for the community and the environment. I mean, I've grown up in this community in both Imperial Beach and San Ysidro, and it's not only affected my health and quality of life, but I know the people that have been affected on both sides of the border, and all the children that will lead our future, and the abundant and biodiverse ecosystem that's been degrading because of a lack of action and accountability. So I urge the regional board to hold IBWC to account and not allow any further delays. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Gallegos. Next is Sarah Davidson, followed by Jeff Carrox, both on Zoom.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Chair Cantu, board members and staff. My name is Sarah Davidson, and I manage the Clean Border Water Now program at the Surfrider Foundation. Thank you for this public hearing and update. We're concerned about the horrific smells that nearby residents have continued to experience for months now, as you've heard from other speakers, as a result of the pilot channel berm failure and flow through Smuggler's Gulch. Sewage is now reaching parts of the valley that have not had sewage before. The campground is flooded, and cities are getting numerous calls from frustrated and concerned residents about the inescapable smell. We all know that this bad smell is caused by contaminated air that is lowering the quality of life and having detrimental health impacts for families living in the area. People cannot open their windows, cannot stand in their yards, cannot spend time in parks without breathing in toxic air. Children are sitting in classrooms for several hours every day in close proximity to flooded areas and also breathing in this toxic air. The long-term health impacts are yet unknown. The communities most impacted are predominantly low income and predominantly communities of color, and this is unacceptable. It remains, as many other speakers have said today, one of the most significant ongoing public health and environmental justice crises in the country. Thank you for the update, Dave Gibson, on addressing the berm repair process. We are glad to know that the Water Board has a plan in place, and we ask you to move faster. While you may be working around dry and nesting seasons, we ask you to prioritize the current devastating impacts to public health and expedite your timetables accordingly. You may be aware that the Tijuana River was recently designated as one of the top 10 most endangered rivers in the United States. The river has made this list not only because of the egregious and ongoing permit violations and threats to water quality and public health, but also because of the opportunity it offers all of us to come together, step up, work harder, and do better in protecting our river and all who depend on it. I spent the last day and a half in Sacramento for California Ocean Day, where hundreds of people, mostly youth, gathered from all over the state to tell their stories and advocate for their local coastlines, waterways, and communities to those in positions to make critical policy and regulation changes. I watched in awe as passionate and driven young people rose to the occasion, despite their nerves and the obstacles they faced to get there, because they cared and because they recognized that our own health and well-being is intricately linked to the health and well-being of our waterways. They understood how important equitable access to safe waterways is to our mental and physical health, our community's well-being, and our collective survival. I implore all of you to also rise to the occasion, to provide immediate attention and leadership on this issue by building additional redundancies into the system, by expediting your timetables to prioritize public health, prioritizing the river diverter, and working with IBWC and the City of San Diego to effectively control transboundary flows. We appreciate all that you are doing, and also, we believe you can do more to protect the waterways that you are responsible for regulating and the communities that they impact. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Davidson. Next is Jeff Crooks. Crooks? Oh, Crooks. Okay. Followed by Courtney Baltiski. Baltiski? She's not with us. Okay. So we're looking at Jeff Crooks.
Yeah. Hello, this is Jeff. I run the research and monitoring program at the Tijuana River National Estuarine Research Reserve and also a longtime participant in the Tijuana River Valley Recovery Team. And I've not given an update on the ecosystem health of the Tijuana River Valley through our long-term monitoring program for a while. So I thought I'd just quickly do that today, especially related to some of the things we're seeing related to the transboundary flows, both the amount of flow that we're seeing and the sort of unseasonal dry weather flows that we've heard about today. So I think we're definitely seeing some signal of that. One of the biggest issues we have is with not just low oxygen hypoxia, but anoxia, like no oxygen. So we have a water quality monitoring station that's been ticking away since 1996, doing every 15-minute temperature saline dissolved oxygen. And we're seeing things we've not really seen before, like just for the past 4 or 5 days, essentially zero oxygen at one of our sites. Now, it's since recovered a little bit, but what we're noticing is that typically we would see that low oxygen or no oxygen when there was a mouth closure event, like no tidal circulation. What we're seeing now is that even during the neap tide series where there's less tidal circulation, but the river mouth still is open, that flushing with ocean water is not enough to counteract the sort of really high oxygen demand in these transboundary flows. So these periods of low oxygen are definitely a concern, anoxia. We think it's also having a biological impact. We're monitoring it through some of our programs. One of the best long-term records of this for the estuary is done by UC Santa Barbara, the Marine Science Institute. The Tijuana estuary is a reference site, actually, for the mitigation salt marsh restoration up in San Dieguito Lagoon. So this is a standard, but we've not been acting so much like a standard the last year or two. In the monitoring that happened in the fall, essentially, they found very few fish species, just a handful on an average. Basically, there were zero species found in the in some of the samples that were taken. And it doesn't mean the whole estuary is completely devoid of life, right? But the numbers are very low and very concerning. And so we're pretty sure it's related to these transboundary flows. We continue to monitor this and keep track of things. These estuaries are resilient systems, so we hope as some of this rehabilitation and improvements come online, we can track some of the recovery of the system as well. But we are seeing some things of concern. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crooks. At this point, I think we are about to conclude. I'll invite the commissioner if you have any final comments in response to what you've heard. And then I'll invite our staff, Ms. Corona, and our executive officer, if you have any final comments.
I think that definitely, you know, really understanding kind of the issues that are going on with the people in the area is really important. We have staff here to listen to the same thing, because I think it's really important that they drive this project and keep it on schedule. What I heard loud and clear is the river diversion project is definitely important to people, and we definitely don't want to repeat studies that have already been done or not use the information in the record of decision. That is definitely going to go into this process of developing the next phase for that. And again, you know, our thought is to have something that we could bid out this year so that we can, not a project, a study that will give us an actual more specific cost, because I'd like to remind the group that the first level of costs that were developed and that was used for the record of decision for our wastewater treatment plant was $300 million.
Right.
And it actually turned out to be $900 million, right? We're only doing $600 million of it. And so really, it's not intended to duplicate. It's not intended to undo what has already been done, but to actually make it more precise. So, and, you know, making our target date, we have it front and center. We have it front and center, and we are working towards that very aggressively, both from a financial resource standpoint, from a staffing resource standpoint, and from my attention on this as well. So rest assured, I'm working hard towards that as well.
Thank you. We share that it is front and center with us as well. Ms. Corona, do you have any final comments?
I just want to briefly say thank you also to the commissioner. And, you know, I transitioned into the MPDS unit at the end of last year so that I can focus fully on these issues, in particular the plant. So just want to remind the board, management, and IBWC and all members of the public that I am available to help address these concerns, and we'll keep plugging away at it.
Thank you. Executive Officer Gibson.
Thank you, Chair Cantu, members of the board and public. I don't have much more to add except that we will see progress in the scale of months in compliance with the time schedule order and the secondary effluent limitations. Junction box one does need to be replaced, but it's not necessary to meet those standards if the primary sedimentation facilities are restored to proper service and operated. However, to truly address the transboundary flows and the pollution issues that are affecting the Tijuana River, that's going to take place over a period of years. And so while we are all pushing forward as rapidly as possible, trying to undo some of the damage that's been caused by excessive flood and sedimentation, for example, that was brought up for Smuggler's Gulch, that's going to require several local agencies with Coastal Commission approvals to take years to try to restore those. We'll do all we can to expedite that from the Water Board's perspective to try to restore that habitat. And I wanted to just say thank you, too, for our speakers today and regrets for those who were not able to join us on Zoom after all, but Dr. Crooks in particular giving us a snapshot of the biological condition of the estuary, I think is very important to remind us what we're working on all this for, in addition to the public health issues that are so paramount and must be addressed in the shortest possible time. So thank you very much for having this item today. We will continue to update you every month with our executive officer's report. Although we do not have a meeting scheduled for June, we will still have an executive officer's report posted for people to read and keep up with these events.
Oh, that's great, and I appreciate that. Let's put this on the agenda for August.
We'll
be slightly before the August 15th deadline, 3 months from now, but let's see how close we are when we meet again in August.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Dr. Olson.
Yes, I'd like to direct this to the executive officer. We have regional air quality control boards, and there's one for this region. I don't know exactly what it's called, but wouldn't it be the one to contact if you think they're air pollution? I mean, not us, but the individuals to contact them if they think they're air pollution issues?
Yes,
Dr. Olson. And Cal EPA has brought in the air pollution control districts and air pollution control board. They have set up additional monitoring stations and are looking at the issues of short-term and long-term health effects issues. I can't speak to their results so far, but certainly the people who are living in and around the Tijuana River Valley are experiencing hydrogen sulfide toxicity, headaches. There's been increased cases of Shigella, we've been told. And as Commissioner Malcolm indicated, there's good reason to believe that some of these pathogens and pollutants can be carried through the air from the water itself. It's not just direct exposure. But that agency has been involved, and Cal EPA remains very, very, very closely focused on this issue and the several jurisdictions responsible under its purview for coordination.
Thank you.
Any other comments, Mr. Sean?
Yeah, just a quick request, Dave. I really appreciated Jeff Crook's comments. And if we could maybe do that periodically, if there's any change, ask him to give you an input, maybe just put it in your executive officer's report. But he knows what he's doing down there, and he's been there a long time, and I appreciate hearing from him periodically.
Thank you, Board Member Strawn. I would add to that, we may very well look to ask for an update from Dr. Crooks and from State Parks on their Tijuana River Estuary restoration projects, the several phases and ambitious plans that they have there for restoring the estuary to adapt to climate change as well as to enhance habitat that has been historically impacted by sediment discharges from Los Laureles Canyon in Mexico. So there's some opportunities there later this year for those updates, and I appreciate bringing them forward to you.
Any other final comments? Okay, our next item is local advancements for PFAS treatment and destruction technologies, and that'll be followed with a closed session. Let's take a 5-minute break, stretch our legs now. Thank you. Let's reconvene. So we'll get started again to a very empty room. So item 4 is local advancements of PFAS, treatments and destruction technologies. This is an update by Brian McDaniel.
Good morning, Chair Cantu, members of the board. My name is Brian McDaniel. I'm an engineering geologist in the site.
View of the district's PFAS program. Dr. Plumlee provided a discussion of several pilot tests conducted in the district. She also discussed the proposed plans for additional testing that included the assessment of new and other techniques available for PFAS removal. Today, Jason Dudakis will provide an update on the status of the district's PFAS treatment program. Jason is the Executive Director of Water Quality and Technical Resources for the Orange County Water District in Fountain Valley, California. In this role, he oversees water quality monitoring, laboratory operations, regulatory compliance, and applied research in support of the district's groundwater management activities and recycled water projects. Jason has helped lead the OC, the Orange County Water District's response to PFAS contamination, which includes a several hundred million dollar wellhead treatment program, cost recovery litigation, public outreach, and coordination with the CDC-funded local epidemiological study. In addition, we are also joined today with John Follin, Director of Strategic Development at General Atomics, who will provide an overview of General Atomics' treatment technology system. This process uses water oxidation and is capable of not only removing PFAS, but also any co-contaminants, as Mr. Follin will explain to the board. In August of 2023, I had the opportunity to attend a public demonstration of General Atomics' treatment system. The destruction technology was developed here in San Diego at the General Atomics San Diego Test Facility. The demonstration showcased a commercial-scale treatment system developed to treat PFAS as well as other contaminants that may occur with PFAS waste. General Atomics started working with Supercritical Technologies in the mid-1990s for defense-related projects, and since 2013 has been successfully selling systems for commercial applications. Starting in 2021, General Atomics has been heavily involved with the destruction of PFAS materials for both industry and government. John Follin graduated from Georgia Tech with a bachelor in nuclear engineering and a master's in nuclear engineering and nuclear physics. John joined General Atomics in 1980. Also online, we have Dan Newton, Assistant Deputy Director with Department of Water Resources. And with that, we will begin with Jason Dudakis from the Orange County Water District.
Thanks, Brian, for that kind introduction. Good afternoon, Chair Cantu, members of the board. Before I get started, I just want to confirm, can everyone see my slides and hear me clearly?
We can.
Great. All right, I'll get started then. Thank you. So just quick outline of what I'll cover today. Just give the board a brief bit of background on OCBD and PFAS. Talk about the current impacts we're seeing on our service area from PFAS and our response to them. And then get into how US EPA's newly promulgated PFAS drinking water regulation changes things for us and how we're responding to that. And then talk about some of our next steps as we move forward. So just a little bit of Orange County Water District. You can see we're located in the watershed just north of you all. We're at the tail end of the Santa Ana River watershed and work closely with the Santa Ana Regional Board on many of our water quality and related programs. Just quick facts about us. We celebrated our 90th anniversary as an independent special district last year. It's our primary mission to manage the Orange County groundwater basin. Through our efforts, it provides currently 85% of the local water supply in area, which is a good thing and it's a relatively high proportion compared to most of coastal Southern California. 2.5 million people in our service area. And our primary stakeholders and customers, if you will, are the 19 large municipal water districts and special districts that are the retail water agencies for our service area. You can kind of think of us functionally as something of a groundwater wholesaler for our area. So real quick on PFAS, I'm sure the board is aware of this, but this is the large family of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. Several thousand chemicals here that feature that carbon fluorine bond in their backbone as their central feature that help in parts the real resilience or recalcitrance of these compounds. They've been around for the last 70 years and found their way into a number of commercial and industrial uses here because of their properties of, non-stick, water resistance, stain resistance, and certainly they're just resilience to degradation. In many consumer applications, those are attractive, but as we're finding is that as they're released into the environment, many of those properties are not as attractive. So shifting to some of the regulations that we've really guided our actions up here in Orange County, and I think statewide as well, your colleagues up at the State Board and the Division of Drinking Water have set forth a number of drinking water advisories for individual PFAS. They're listed here. There are four of them currently. These are made up of typically a notification level and response level, two different thresholds that have two different sets of response actions for utilities that in their potable water supplies exceed these levels. The real bright line for us and our member agencies in our service area has been the response level. That carries with it a recommendation from the Division of Drinking Water not to serve water above that threshold, and that if water continues to be served or must be served above that, an extensive public notification program is required. So that's been the real bright line for us, and I think others statewide. And just did want to note that in addition to these four, the state has said that they plan on developing additional advisories for five additional PFAS listed on the slide here. So, starting with many of the monitoring orders the state drinking water regulators sent out in the 2019-2020 timeframe and since then, and collecting that data and then comparing it to those advisories, that resulted in 62 wells in our service area being temporarily taken out of service for exceeding that response level. And we have about 220 total wells in our service area. So pretty significant impact to us. All these wells started out kind of in that left-hand column here, the planning and design stage. But through our efforts over the last 3 or 4 years, we now have been able to construct 38 treatment systems that are in operation today, restoring those wells to service, working very closely with our retail agency partners. And the balance, the remaining 24, are either in design or construction. We expect those in construction to be operational by the end of this calendar year, and just those few in design to probably leak into 2025 for completion. It's a $300 million capital program to accomplish this. So significant resources have been needed to pull this off. And temporarily, while this is going, you know, these wells were taken out of service. And so our service areas had to rely a bit more on the imported water supply, and groundwater pumping was depressed for the last several years while these systems were under construction. Now groundwater pumping is increasing with the treatment available on these wells. And, you know, this has a big financial impact to our member agencies and their ratepayers. Essentially, the imported water from a wholesale perspective costs these agencies about double what it costs to pump groundwater. And so our incentives were all aligned in terms of trying to get the groundwater and the impacted wells back online as soon as possible. To help with this, our board adopted a policy in November 2019 that Orange County Water District would take the lead on the financing, design, and construction of these PFAS treatment systems for these large retail agencies impacted wells. Once construction was complete, we would turn over ownership to the retail agency with an obligation to operate and maintain both the well and the treatment system for a 30-year period. And then those operating costs would be shared 50-50 between the agency and Orange County Water District. Eligibility was confirmed for this program in terms of a well being impacted above that state response level, one of those, or a future maximum contaminant level. And so we've executed agreements with the vast majority of our retailers to execute these projects in this manner. You know, as a part of this, kind of contemporaneously, we did a PFAS treatment study. I believe my colleague Megan Plumlee, when she spoke to you, two, maybe 3 years ago now, gave you an overview of this. This is where we evaluated various absorbent media at both the laboratory and the pilot scale, really focusing on mostly established technologies like granular activated carbon and ion exchange resins, but really trying to narrow down the actual type, the specific, you know, type of these materials that would be best suited for PFAS treatment in our area. And at the same time, we did test some of the emerging alternative absorbents made of different materials that were just coming on the market at that time. And so, you know, our phase one findings, I believe Dr. Plumlee shared these with you before. You know, we found that basically all of these technologies can work. It's just that some are better than others, right? Some last longer. Some appear to have, you know, greater sorption capacity than others. And this has really helped inform our procurement of these media during the construction phase, such that we can competitively bid them with some knowledge of how they're performed and account for that when purchasing them. And so it's turned out, you know, the facilities we've built, I mentioned we have, you know, facilities at 38 wells or 38 wells receiving treatment. The vast majority of those so far to date have been ion exchange facilities using those synthetic resins as a means of removing PFAS from the impacted wells. This has largely been driven by the smaller footprint required by ion exchange facilities. As you can see from this photo, and this is emblematic of many of our sites here in Orange County, you know, we're in a very suburban, urbanized area. Land is at a premium. We're really trying to shoehorn this treatment in at the existing well site when we can. That avoids cost of conveyance or of purchasing additional land for treatment. And so ion exchange has let us do that. And again, in the vast majority of cases. Before the water is treated by the resin, we do use cartridge or bag pre-filters there to make sure there are no smart particulates that can foul the resin. We're actually finding through the initial operation of these systems that the resin is lasting longer at this full scale as compared to the pilot. And looking back, we believe that our pilot may have had a little more challenging water quality than what the majority of the retail agency wells have. You know, we have one facility that's been online for nearly 3 years that has not needed a resin changeout of its lead vessel as of yet. Whereas another large facility just recently replaced their lead resin after more than 2 years of operation, where our piloting predicted something more like 12 or 15 months of life. So we've been fortunate that our operating costs have been a little lower than perhaps initially estimated. For the time being, the spent resin that we have changed out has been sent to a permitted incineration facility in the state of Utah. But as I'll talk later, we're looking at alternatives to that for the long term. So I do want to shift now to the announcement from last month from USEPA about their PFAS drinking water regulation that they promulgated. In many respects, it was similar to the draft regulation they put out in the spring of 2023. The maximum contaminant levels for PFOA and PFOS were unchanged at that 4 part per trillion level, as shown here. One change EPA did make is that they broke out the next three PFAS listed here with individual MCLs set at 10 parts per trillion. They were previously only in the hazard index in that next line of multiple PFAS that were grouped together in something of an aggregated rule. But now they appear with their own thresholds here. We believe that's because some of the risk assessments underlying them were finalized during the interim period after the draft. And then the hazard index continues. This groups those three PFAS with one more and has them assessed sort of against their individual health metrics and then summed such that the effect of those four compounds are considered in aggregate. So just a kind of a graphical depiction of the impacts of this in our basin up in Orange County. Again, here's our service area. As I mentioned, we have about 220 large system retail wells in the county or in our service area, a portion of the county, the north and central region. These green dots here show the 38 wells that have been brought back online with treatment to date through our existing program. This shown kind of in light green now, these are the 24 outstanding wells that are either in the design or construction phase, the majority of which, again, we anticipate to be completed by the end of this calendar year. And then these blue dots here, these are now we've found through our testing 40 additional wells that will require treatment or some other kind of mitigation to comply with the 4 part per trillion federal MCL for PFOA and PFOS. Compliance with that, with the MCL under EPA's rule as required by 2029. A 5-year compliance period, as is allowed under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, was included in the final rule from EPA. So it's a little bit more of those timeframes. There are various timeframes within the new rule. Within 3 years, folks must do their initial monitoring. We're pretty well ahead of the curve of that in our service area, given the response to the state monitoring orders that's occurred to date. Then starting in 3 years, within the next 2 years, so 2027 to 2029, folks essentially have to report the results of their initial monitoring, begin doing that. Again, that's something we're a bit ahead on, because either through voluntarily or through the required testing, the state of California requires your PFAS results to be in your annual consumer confidence reports and be reported. And so again, shouldn't have too much trouble meeting that. And as I stated earlier, US EPA is allowing 5 years for drinking water systems to comply with this rule, with the MCL and have to start making any public notifications related to violations for this. This is one change from the draft that was issued last year. The draft had kind of the Safe Drinking Water Act's default 3-year compliance period here. But EPA in the final rule extended it to 5 years and stated in that that the rationale for that is they understood the technical, financial, and other burdens associated with nationwide compliance with this, that a 5-year compliance period would be appropriate. Shifting to the state of California's MCL process, I think as the board is likely aware, for a state MCL, that needs to be underpinned by a public health goal. Those are developed by your colleagues over in the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, or OEHA. They interestingly finalized their PhDs for PFOA and PFOS right before EPA's announcement of the EPA MCL. And those public health goals are for PFOA, 0.007 parts per trillion, or 7 parts per quadrillion. That is based on a review of epidemiological studies indicating increased prevalence or occurrence of kidney cancer in humans with increasing exposure to PFOA. The PFOS public health goal is set at 1 part per trillion based on a review of laboratory studies, laboratory animal studies. And so now it turns, the ball is in the court of the State Division of Drinking Water, up at the state board. You know, there are some, I think most of us in the regulated community are familiar with the state kind of promulgating their own MCL, as they've done recently for hexavalent chromium and prior to that for chlorate. My understanding is there are some different important differences with now the state accepting primacy and essentially adopting and enforcing US EPA MCL. And, you know, one of the things will that'll be that remains to be seen is will DDW make any changes to EPA's final rule here as a part of their implementation or otherwise? For example, will they stick with EPA's timeframes for testing, reporting, and compliance or otherwise? My very limited understanding is that the state's process of adopting an MCL is aided if there is a federal MCL. For example, their need to do an economic analysis is lessened. They can rely largely on what EPA has done to calculate the costs and benefits of the federal MCL, and that any significant deviations from what EPA has done would require more analysis by the state and extend the implementation. So to wrap it up here, just want to let you know our kind of where we're headed. Obviously, we're focused on finishing our current phase of design and construction of the well treatment systems. We've already begun design on the additional 40 impacted wells. Again, from the draft rule that came out last year, we had a sense of, you know, that this was coming. And so we're able to put the pieces in place to be ready to jump on this as soon as it was released last month. We're aggressively seeking state and federal grant funding. You know, this is an expensive effort, as you can imagine. Our current estimates of the total you know, capital program for this, both phases are right around about $550 million. Adding in 30 years of operating costs of these systems is pushing our estimate of total response costs over that period to approximately $1.8 billion. And so we don't think it's appropriate to have our ratepayers, you know, fund all that, certainly by any means. And so we're aggressively looking for state and federal assistance where possible. We're also in the process of putting together our claims for the class action, effectively class action settlements that are reached for water systems with 3M and DuPont that were announced basically last year now. And we're hoping to recover, you know, significant monies from that from the parties responsible for the development and distribution of PFAS. And finally, we'll continue with many phases and aspects of pilot testing. We're always looking at new absorbent medias here, ones that can last longer for us that are cost effective to hopefully drive down some of those operating costs. We're interested in new PFAS measurement techniques. There's interest in ways to kind of get a better handle on the entire PFAS family through some sort of total or aggregate or bulk measurements that attempt to tell you how much total PFAS is in a sample versus the very targeted approaches we use now. And so we're very interested in those and working with the state on their consideration of those and how they may be used going forward. And certainly in close, we're interested in destructive techniques for PFAS. We acknowledge that having a resin hauled out of state for an incineration might work now, but there's certainly some long-term questions about the sustainability and perhaps the regulations surrounding that. And so, you know, certainly be interested in hearing your next speaker talk about their technology, as we're always looking for, you know, a better, cheaper, faster way to destroy this stuff that potentially could be more localized for us. So with that, I appreciate the board's interest in this topic and your attention. And I'm happy to take any questions now or certainly waiting until our second speaker is done. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Mr. Dudakis? Yes.
Back at the map of the affected wells, it did not seem that it was an even distribution. Is that, have you studied that? Is it deeper wells, shallower wells, industrial locations, or?
Yeah, no, good question. Yeah, we think compared to a lot of areas around the country facing PFAS issues, our occurrence story is probably somewhat unique. We have not identified sort of a single point source be that an industrial release, or even let's say a release of a firefighting foam from a facility use that, that's responsible for this. Certainly we know that, you know, there are three DOD facilities in Orange County and we've been working with them and they're in the middle of investigations required by our regional board. And like all those facilities and even, you know, the local municipal airport here, they've had releases of PFAS, right? They've used this stuff for years. They've trained with it. They put out fires with it. But we're finding that just based on where those cities are, those sites are located, that the local geology is to date kind of preventing that from impacting local groundwater supplies. We believe there's a nexus between our occurrence and proximity to the Santa Ana River. Historically, the river is infiltrated into the groundwater basin here. Certainly capturing that as part of our managed aquifer recharge program here. Unfortunately, we consistently detect PFAS in those surface waters entering Orange County from upstream. And, you know, there are a variety of potential sources there. Thankfully, those levels are going down, but we do think that's going to be a long-term effort, likely working with our regional board about managing PFAS in local surface waters.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Dudakis? Before you go, I want to thank you for a great presentation, and I'm particularly thankful to you for the quality of your slides and the size of the font. It's appropriate for a room of this size, and I know you have many board members and are used to presenting to a large room, and it shows, and it is very much appreciative. Thank you.
Appreciate your comments, Chair, too. Happy to provide the information, and thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. And our next presenter is Mr. There you go. Sorry, I did not write down your name, and now I don't remember it.
Oh, I've been called various names. My name is John Fallon from General Atomics.
Thank you, John.
Yes, no problem. So I have some slides that are being brought up. I want to thank Brian for inviting me here to the board, and I want to thank you for allowing me to present.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, it's interesting. There we go. Very good. Thank you very much. So today I am going to talk about our work that we're doing with supercritical water oxidation. We've been selling this technology for destruction of organics for a long time, but recently we've been dragged into the PFAS environment. So I'm pushing the... I'm not getting it next. So somebody could just increment it for me.
I hope somebody can really look at the remote going forward. Every speaker's had problems with it.
Okay, there we go. Very good. So General Atomics is a company located in San Diego, California. We do a lot of work with the United States government, both the Department of Defense and Department of Energy. We have a large presence here in San Diego, and we're proud of being here in San Diego. I am a director of strategic development, which means my job is to take our products, work with different organizations, private and government, and see if we can transition them for use in the government's sphere. So a little bit of a background, and I'll get into what the technology actually is. But in the late 1990s to 2000, we were developing supercritical water oxidation for the destruction of a variety of chemicals from the government, propellant, rocket propellant, explosives, oils and paints. And that was pretty good. And we did spend a lot of time doing research until we finally got the process nailed down. By 2012, we have a finished product, and we started selling that. We had our first commercial sale in 2012 by a company called Westinghouse, bought our systems for the destruction of a variety of different types of organic acids. From then on, we then said, okay, we got a really good commercial product. From 2015, we started selling the items for commercial use. And this is for destruction of all types of organics like pesticides, PCBs, all the carbon tetrachloride products, corrosive solvent waste, you name it, we've been selling them. It's a very niche market. It's for a company that doesn't want to ship their waste off-site. They want to destroy it on-site. So we were doing pretty good in 2000 into 2021 until a four-letter word crept into our lexicon, and that was PFAS. And the EPA came to us and said, hey, you've guys got yourself a product that destroys organics. We want to test using your technology for PFAS material. And they picked the most common use, which is the AFFF, the aqueous firefighting foam. We did testing with the EPA, did testing with the U.S. government out of Tyndall Air Force Base for the Air Force. And we also did testing with a company that was previously mentioned earlier today called Arcadis, because Arcadis is very interested in using the technology for destroying other types of waste that contains PFAS. Testing went very, very well with that in 2022, went very good. And so now we still continue selling our products for organic waste destruction. We have not really entered the actual destruction of PFAS in the commercial field yet, but we've won four large government contracts about actually deploying systems and running tests, really working the systems hard to show that we can destroy PFAS to as many nines as possible. And I'll get to that in a moment. I'm going to be very simple about it. The technology is not very complicated. If you take water and I put oil in there, it does not mix. The oil is on the top. Well, when you pressurize it to 4,000 PSI and you heat it to 650 degrees, you get in yourself a very unique situation where it's supercritical, where the water is dissolved and the oil is dissolved in the water. And we have excess oxygen in there and the organics are completely destroyed. So this is our simple process. We use process air. We pump in water and fuel to get the reactor going. Then we pump in the waste. And then we use sodium hydroxide to quench it if there's any halogens like chlorines, bromines, and fluorines so we can neutralize them. Comes out through a gas liquid separator. We have liquid effluent and gas effluent. This is a really good process for destroying on-site waste destruction. If you don't want to ship your waste or you can't ship your waste, where you can't find somebody to either incinerate it or deep well inject it, this is a great technology. So we've been pretty good with it from the non-PFAS side, but now we're getting very much into the PFAS side. And the last bullet is waste stream testing at GA. We have a large facility. Brian and others have visited there. And at the end, I encourage, if you're ever interested in coming to our facility to see the testing we're going to be doing on new PFAS materials, you're welcome to come. Bottom line is you take water, you mix it with waste, heat it up to 650 degrees, pressurize it, and it destroys the organics.
So I want to make sure I understand. You oxygenate it to death?
We don't oxygenate it to death. We just make sure that there's just enough oxygen that all the carbon chains, when they break down, they react with the oxygen. Right. We don't add too much oxygen, just enough so that every carbon goes to carbon dioxide, and then all the free hydrogens go to oxygen to make H2O. Uh-huh. And I have a little chart on that. That's a good question. But this is not an incineration process. This is done in quenched environments, so you don't make dioxins, you don't make furans. You avoid the problems that you have with incineration. It's just a completely in-water environment. A little hot, but it's an environment. We sell systems, both transportable and fixed ice school systems. We call it government speak TRL 8 or 9. That means commercially deployable. We're not playing around in a laboratory. We're not doing bench scale testing. We sell systems. That's fine. But my job here today is not to talk about selling systems, is where we're going with PFAS, because that is a phenomenal problem in the United States. And I'll say the previous speaker, when he mentioned that there's 1,000 species, I think the last conference I attended, there are 15,000 different types of species of PFAS and PFOA, and they don't have an idea what all these things can do to people. So before PFAS, these are the things that we used our school system for. But one thing about our technology that is, we can destroy all these different types of halogenated compounds, but also if that is mixed in with a PFAS waste, we can destroy it all. We don't have to, we're not regulated, or we don't have a specific thing we have to only destroy, like, quote, pure PFAS waste, but we can destroy a variety of co-contaminants with this PFAS waste, which is really great for the technology. But these are some of the things that we have done and we've sold systems for. So, of course, I wish all things were liquid, but sometimes you don't get liquid. We're working with a variety of sources of companies, the wood industry that has contaminated wood. We have a program with them. We take the wood, we grind it up, send it into as a slurry. We do carbon, granulate activated carbon, and other type of carbon materials. We have an interesting project out of Nevada for mining ore, for destroying our carbonaceous material in that. Plastics, rubber, working with companies, especially a company in South Korea, for getting rid of micronized or small types of plastics that are found in water, working with them. We do the resin beads, and of course, the bottom left or the bottom right is a slurry that we're working with biosolids. Not a pretty sight, but that's what it was set into the system. So to handle all these different things for liquid feeds, we have high pumps. Slurry feeds for GAC, resins, pharmaceuticals, we have high pressure pumps. We do take reverse osmosis. That is that if you have a large water supply and if you have parts per million, instead of running the pure water or the water with the contaminants through our SCWO system, you can run them through a reverse osmosis. And then we take the reject from that and goes right into the SCWO so you can destroy the concentrate. In fact, that's very popular along with other type of concentration materials that from leachates and things where you concentrate the waste and then we can run our system through it. Thermal desorptions and gas diffusions for all their types of strange type of applications for contaminants in soil and in water. We have a test facility at General Atomics. We are not a thermal treatment system, like we don't take waste and destroy it. We have a treatability permit from the state of California, so we do treatability tests. So we get waste and then we run testing through the system to verify that A, the technology works, and the B, to get the data that's needed by the people running the test so they can supply it to their permitters of the state. And this is what the EPA came. They lived with us for 4 days and ran the system, ran it ragged to really prove out that the system works. So again, we're not doing R&D on this. This is confirmatory data only to show that the process works and they can get their permits. So I had a complicated set of slides, but I just condensed it all into one where this is what we've done for the last couple of years, non-PFAS. We've done with the slurries, working with slurries. We can handle slurries very well. and halogenated organic feeds, a couple of them. I got a list of hundreds that we've done, but this is just a summary and some other organic feeds. I guess my bottom line is this technology is not theoretical. It's not laboratory. It does work. It works very well with these type of compounds with organics. But however, now let's talk about the PFAS, because this is what's really critical. So the PFAS molecule contains some hydrogen, oxygen, fluorines, and carbon. It's a carbon chain. And what we do is we bring in a little bit more oxygen, and there's excess water, and we run it through our reactor, and we produce the CO2 from the degradation or the oxidation of the carbon chain, water generated from either water that's existing or coming from the oxidation of the carbon chains. The nitrogen's from the air. Oxygen is excess oxygen from the air. And then we make HF, hydrofluoric acid. And of course, because the fluorines, when they're broken away from the carbon chain, they're looking for somebody to mate up with, and there's hydrogen. Hey. You know, hydrogen, fluorine, they get together. But immediately we neutralize it with sodium hydroxide, and then we make sodium fluoride. Now, we know this works very well. We've done testing on this. But from our chlorinated and our brominated organics that we've done for around the world, the chlorines do made up with the sodium, they make sodium chloride and sodium bromide. So we have detected, when we run the system, we have never detected any organic fluorine coming out of the stack or in the water. So our total organic fluorine is zero, but we have total inorganic fluorine, which is the sodium, which is documented. So that's the kind of the feed. We get all that, works quite well. We make no sodium fluoride. We make sodium fluoride, but we don't make any HF or F2, and this has been measured. So there you go. So this is kind of a data, and again, I don't want to drown everybody in data, but I'll say this. My email address is at the back. If anybody's interested, we have the Arcadis report that did the first three testing on the test on the table there. The EPA report did the next three, and that is an extensive report. If you love data, if you love to get into the nitty-gritty of tables and information, these reports, I can get them to you. And then the last report, we just finished a surface activation foam fractionation process testing, where you take the waste material from leachates and you bubble it up and you separate the water from the foam, and then we destroyed that pure foam. So it's a concentrated leachate into our system, and it worked very, very well. So we've done resin beads, we've done leachate. So this is what we've done last year. Now, the thing is, again, there's a lot of testing, because before you deploy your system, you want to show the EPA and you want to show the community that you really are destroying these forever chemicals, right? You're not just masking them or doing something. You really are destroying them. So we've won these big test programs under a company, Bay West, located in Minnesota, under the ERDC, Army Corps of Engineer program. We have a very large, big two-year program where we're destroying a variety of PFAS waste. And I have a list of that. It's amazing. We're going to be throwing all sorts of things at it at GA. Then once we've got that, we're going to take one of our systems and deploy it at a government site and run it for a year. And again, we're going to be out in an environment, and it's going to be harsh, and we're going to throw all sorts of PFAS waste, or not we, the government will, to verify that the technology really does work. Because before you deploy things, you want to make sure that it really does do what it's supposed to do. We also have a Defense Innovation Unit project from the U.S. government. It's a two-year program where we're doing some testing, but then we're going to be deploying a system at a clean earth facility in Charlotte, North Carolina, and that will be testing a wide variety of also PFAS waste. We have a Tetra Tech program for destroying Navy GAC. We have Arcadis, which was mentioned earlier. We have a big program with them for destroying aqueous firefighting foam, high concentration, 3,000 parts per million. Destroying it, and we're going to do that test. We're doing that test in a couple of weeks. And then an Axe Nano project from the Air Force. So we have a number of big government PFAS programs. So this is just what we're going to be testing. What is unique here, and I'm not an expert on this, but we are going to be doing, when we do the first three testing, wherever that little Jason thing is, we're going to be doing a full gas and a full liquid, and we're going to be doing the OTM, the other test method, 45 and 50 for the testing for the particular PFAS and PFOA molecules. I mean, this is a really comprehensive test. It's just got rolled out. We're going to be doing these three tests here with concentrated AFFF. We're getting airport fire pit water from a variety of airports around the United States that we're going to be testing, that because that's just these pits that, you know, all the AFFF lives in, along with other chemicals, including dead animals, that you want to be able to process. So we're going to be doing that. And then we got the concentrated leachate, a very high concentrated leachate, PFAS, coming from one of the sites up north. So this is great. And then we have our GAC programs, and then we have our other PFAS waste streams from private companies. I can't mention them from NDAs, but you can probably get a feel for the big companies that we're probably testing for them. And then we got resin exchange beads we're going to be getting from Orange County Water District. The previous speaker, Christine, has been fantastic in setting this up, along with the people at Orange County. We're going to be doing that, testing that, and getting them some data. And I can go on and on, but there's a lot that we're going to be doing. Testing this year is the year for testing to show that technology works, so that we can deploy them at various government and private sites to get online. So the two systems are repaired for the government site. We've got one system going to Army Corps of Engineer, as I mentioned, and we think we've got a site, but the government's working on that right now. And then the second system is going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina. And they're very simple systems. You see in the picture, they're small footprint, 8 foot wide, 20 foot long, very small little compact systems. If you go see them, they're just, if you could deal with the pressure and the temperature, you could build them out of Legos. I mean, they're just very simple. Just the high pressure and high temperature requires some very unique construction things. Again, these tests are going to prove it. Intensive testing plan. I cannot stress that more. A lot of PFAS waste are going to be thrown at us. We're going to be in a real industrial environment outside, not in the laboratory, but we're taking two of our commercial systems and sending it there. A complete gas and liquid analysis will be done by the U.S. government, the Army Corps, and Arcadis will be doing that, and a company, a whole bunch of other companies. I mean, there's just a lot of people that are interested in these tests for the government, and I just can't say how much sampling is going to be done. It's going to be a sampling test. The cost data will be analyzed too, how much to destroy PFAS. And there's other systems that we're working with different other companies on for PFAS. But again, this is in parallel to our normal organic non-PFAS sales effort too. So we're still working with those people. We got a big project for herbicide destruction, a big project for PCBs. So we're just continuing on with those two. So this is my conclusion. I'm thank you for your time. I just want to say that I do encourage you someday, if you want to come to General Atomics, we're going to be doing a lot of testing in a little bit in May, a lot in June, some in July. You're welcome to come. The third bullet's critical because this is where, you know, if the government and private corporations want to get rid of their PFAS, we have various ways. You can destroy the pure PFAS streams. You can dilute them. Or if they're diluted, you can destroy landfill leachates either using pure streams or concentrated feeds. The first bullet, you know, I meant to say that you can also handle for reverse osmosis. The more you concentrate it, the SCO system doesn't mind. It just makes it more economical because you can destroy more concentrated than having less. We do GAC, resin beads, filtration medians, and biosolids. So we're going to be, I didn't mention, but we have a big biosolids program we're going to be also doing with Orange County Sanitation and some other groups from Broward County, from Atlanta, and from Salt Lake City. So there's the summary of it. We've got a lot of years here of doing it. We're not a startup. We just didn't introduce it today. And this whole PFAS thing is interesting. I mean, it's just exploded. It's all this work that we're doing because the government wants to make sure before they say they're banning any type of destruction of PFAS, you've got at least some solutions for destroying that. So I do appreciate your time. And then thank you, Brian, for inviting me here. If there's any questions, I'd be more to answer. And I'll say on my next last slide is my email address. If you're interested in any of the reports, I've got reports that I can send you that you would read. And if you like the engineering aspects and the chemistry, the organic chemistry, there's fascinating, all the things that the EPA and Arcadis and the other companies did.
Ms. Tu.
Oh, thank you, Chair.
Yeah.
So, John, once the system does its job,
right,
it's still in the liquid form, correct? And then where would that go? To our waste system?
Okay, so what happens is you have if you have liquid, or let's say, for example, you have resin beads. So any type of way that you feed the material in, you can grind up the resin beads, or you have the liquid like from the leachate with the concentrated that goes into the system. And because of the high temperature and high pressure, it just rips apart. I mean, if you can imagine, if you're an organic molecule and you're in 650 degrees C, you're not going to survive quite long. You get ripped apart. So it destroys it. So all those things get pulled apart, and the carbon's made up with the oxygen to make CO2 and all that. So you have all complete breakdown. So you don't have any chains. No carbon chains are left because they cannot withstand that temperature. So you have a liquid output, and we also have a gas output. And the gas output is steam. So we have steam coming out, and then we have liquid. And the liquid is such that you can dispose of that in a public works treatment system because there's no PFAS in it, right? Any type of acids that were generated are neutralized, so you have a little bit of salt. And then any other types of metals that might be in there are oxidized, like iron oxide or copper oxide or cesium oxide, and that's sent out. And because we have a treatability permit at GA, before we release it to the water system, we take the sample. We have holding tanks. We take the sample, get it analyzed. So we test, and then we analyze. And then if it's acceptable, then we release it to the public works treatment system. So we don't discharge unless we know that it has been destroyed.
Dr. Olson.
So you said one of your products was sodium fluoride.
Yes.
And which is very toxic. So what's done with that product?
Okay, so that product is in a very low amount because it reacts with the fluorines that you make when you have this AFFF, you have the carbon chains and you have all the fluorines, and the fluorines get ripped apart, and then they need to go somewhere, right? So they either hit F2 or they go with the hydrogen to make HF. So we neutralize that, so all the sodium fluoride comes out as a salt, and we discharge that, and it's a very low quantity salt. The total inorganic fluorine is very small, and that gets discharged. But we do measure that, and that gets discharged in the public works treatment system as a low concentrated salt.
So I noticed that you look like you were, your maximum volumes that you showed in that one chart was about 2,200 to 2,500 gallons.
Well, so that's over a period of time. So right now we have systems that run between 3 to 5 gallons per minute, and we can run them in parallel. But the gallons that we get are with the gallons of our customers ask us to process. So the government says, we want you to process this amount of material. So sometimes they're sent to us in totes, which is 275 gallons. So we have some number of totes that we process.
So what would be the cost per volume, per unit volume? I don't know how you're looking at unit volumes, but since you're working at high temperature and high pressure,
So I'll tell you what, I can get that information to you because, let's see, not next week, but the following week, we're going to be running a very comprehensive testing with AFFF, and we're going to be collecting the electrical costs from the air compressor and the heating costs. Now, the heating, we use a little bit of diesel fuel as an exothermic reaction inside the reaction. If we're destroying solvent, we don't need any fuel because the solvent has its own fuel source. But AFFF, it doesn't have much, not much heat content. There's not much energy content, a little bit, but you need a little bit of extra. We add a little bit of diesel fuel to allow the reaction going on inside the reactor. So we don't externally heat it.
So you put it under pressure.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
And to pressurize things.
Right.
It takes energy.
Right. That's from the air compressor. You're correct. The high pressure air compressor does, and we're going to measure those electrical costs. Yes.
And then you have the temperature.
Right. And the temperature is done is either the waste itself has enough energy content that allow the reaction just to go, on.
Exothermic.
Right, exothermic. Or if the energy content is less than 2,200 pounds, BTU per pound, then we have to add a little bit of either alcohol or a little bit of diesel fuel or some type of solvent to get that energy content, the heat content, so that the reaction is autogenic. We call it autogenic. It happens automatically in the reactor.
Okay, and then, so is CO2 a product of?
CO2 is definitely a product. We have the data, but it's still very low, 20 parts per million. I mean, I've got the data, we can get that. But the product's very low, but it is a result of taking organics and breaking them down and oxidizing them. However, we don't have a lot of CO2, like an incinerator might have a lot because they have to heat up the air and they have to heat up the chamber. What's destroyed is exactly what needs to destroy in that reactor, all the organics.
Okay.
It's a stoichiometric balance, but we make it work with that so we don't have excess oxygen.
So what you envision is the
the PFAS, PFOA.
Yeah, and all else.
All the 15,000 that they know of now.
Being destroyed either by resins or something, and then you're going to take the waste and you're going to destroy the waste, and your destruction process, it will be more cost efficient, you think?
Well,
than for incineration?
For the non-PFAS, for our past organic work that we've done, it has been. Yes, it is. Because you don't have to ship the stuff, you don't have to fill out your manifest, and you don't have to worry about incineration, which has its issues. For the PFAS, yes, we can take the pure liquid, but that's kind of silly. Or you can take it off as a concentrate. So we got the concentrate, we got the GAC, as you mentioned, and we also have the exchange, the resin beads. And those can be processed directly into the system and destroyed in the reactor system, yes. And we're going to be doing more testing in June and July to prove that, along with biosolids.
So would it be, I'm just wondering if it would be cost effective for the water industry, because now they're saying they have a 3-year lifetime,
right,
and it looks like it's going to extend beyond
SCWO makes no sense if we are going to pop that into a direct water system like the
can't do it. That
wouldn't make any sense. No. But the GAC or the resin beads that they produce and are now shipping to Idaho or Utah for destruction, right? If they wanted to, they could have a small system instead of a big incinerator. They can have a small system that is dedicated for destroying that material, so they don't have to do the shipping costs, and you don't have to worry about incineration at another state.
So the key to this then is the cost to treat the waste. Now, it's probably very cost effective for fire foam and things of that nature.
It is. However, you put your thumb right at it because the technology works. The question is, the government wants to know, if we say this is the technology we want people to use, mm-hmm. is it cost effective, or are you going to go bankrupt by implementing it? So this is the whole reason for these government projects, is to get the data for the EPA, get the data for the state houses, and show the cost data. Is this really a technology that can work, or is this something that just is just unaffordable? Now, from our non-PFAS, it works for those that have this type of organic waste. But for the PFAS, we'll find out.
So what's the concentration you feel you need in the waste to be able
to be effective?
No, to make it effective, to make it cost effective.
Yes. So I would say right now we're looking at between 3,000 parts per million, which is really heavy concentrated mm-hmm. material, to probably around maybe 100 parts per million, something like that. But I'm going to have better information soon on that. So just stand by. I'll have more data.
Great. Okay, well, sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any more questions on this side? Okay, two.
Help me understand something. Your source water, is it just from a municipal source water, or do you have to actually have H2O pure liquid?
No, the source water we get from all these people has already got water mixed in it. So there's already a water-based element to it. I'm just saying is that there's no such thing as pure AFFF that doesn't have a water base in it. So I'm just saying there's water that comes with it. Now, from the pharmaceutical industry, or for some industries that have a pure organic with and a very high concentrated and very little water, we have to add a little bit of water so that the reaction occurs. So, for example, you said, hey, we have motor oil. Well, okay, I need a little bit of water to allow that motor oil to be dissolved inside the reactor and then oxidized. Yes. But for PFAS, we're fine with the water.
Yeah. And I'm kind of wondering, though, water have other particle in it. It's not just H2O.
Right. So we can handle that. We have done, like when we do the leachate, as you can well imagine, not only has the PFAS, but it's got other chlorinated compounds, other brominated compounds from like the fire retardant industry. So we can process that. So you get salt, we can have a high salinity salt loading coming in. Reaction doesn't care. We can have phosphates. We can have other types of things that can come in there, and it's all taken care of and destroyed. And then they're decomposed into their basic organic or their compounds. Yes, and that's the test that we're going to be doing with the airport fire pit water and the concentrated leachate, because it's going to be a mess. It's going to smell, and it's going to be a real organic stew of stuff to destroy, along with a lot of inorganic things too.
Another question, Dr.
Orson. Yeah.
I just have one more quick question. So if everything proves out positively, how long will it be before these things will be in production
for
people to buy?
That's a very good question. And so the first two systems are going to the government sites, and like I said, the government's going to throw everything they can at it. After that, I mean, we still sell commercial systems now, but once the government reports are issued, I would say probably early next year, but you know how reports take a while to get through the system with all the signing authorities. I would imagine probably the information will be released probably a year from now. That will be, hey, this is a way to destroy PFAS. But we're going to be issuing interim reports. And Brian, if you're interested, I can keep you updated on all that, because as we go through all the different testing that we do issue interim reports. This is what we get before the final results. As you know, doing the OTM 45 and 50, which is the glassware, which is very complicated, it's very expensive to do it, because you're looking at parts per trillion, right? And just think about it. If you got glassware and you have one little thing in there, it messes it up. So it's a very expensive, but it's very good to determine how many nines that you can destroy the material. Yeah.
So unintended consequences. So I would love for us to get those information from you, because sometimes theory sounds great, but unintended consequences can come up.
No, reports are yours. I mean, in fact, I can send the EPA report, the Arcadis report, the government report, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Authority report on the SAF program. I can get that to Brian when I get back to the office, and then you can read it.
Well, this sounds like a very clean and a great next step in the process, and it gives us hope that we can see a future without PFAS.
Well, thank you very much. And again, you got my email address in the back. If you ever want to reach out and come see our facility while we're actually doing some government testing, please come. It's amazing with that. And all the glassware and the samples that we're doing, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's just, like I said, it's a sampling program instead of a test program. But thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Again, Brian, thank you. And if any of you have any questions, you have my email address. Send out emails and I'll get back to you. But I will send you those reports when I get back to the office. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Well, this concludes our agenda. We'll move, we will recess into closed session now. And will we be going upstairs? Okay, and we will be going upstairs. At the end, we will report out as to what, if any, actions were taken. Shall we announce this is for personnel?
Yeah, it's for consideration of the evaluation of performance of the executive officer, item 8.
Always a happy activity.